I think you owe me an apology. If indeed you were looking at your iPad at the agenda, then that's simply all you had to say that day. I watched you look at your device through three speakers of public comment whose items were not on that agenda. I think you owe Jeff Edwards an apology for suggesting that the board sell his dog.
Thank you, Ms. Tacker.
And all of San Luis Obispo County.
Thank you, Ms. Tacker. Gwen Taylor, followed by Mike Brown.
Good morning. My name is Gwen Taylor, and I'm a resident of Los Osos. The ISJ agreement was signed 4 years ago. Those in the prohibition zone are told little of what has been accomplished, yet we are paying for much of this agreement. The meters installed in Sunset Terrace were a individual property improvement, which is showing conservation, and where necessary, have the information of high water usage audits. But where is the basin management plan? Where is the conservation plan? Where are individual apartment complexes? When are individual apartment house complexes going to be metered for controlled water usage? Where is the plan to target high water uses in all purveyors' districts? Where is the retrofit program, and how are these funds going to be used for serving and saving devices with low-flow toilets, shower heads, faucets, and other water-saving devices for the more efficient use of water for all of Los Osos? Where is the incentive for replacing turf with drought-tolerant landscaping, a subject today? Where is the grant funding that was applied for with the purpose of water conservation under the Memorandum of Understanding as required by the state when competing for bond funding? Where's the money? And where is the county when the community of Los Osos needs to be informed of the overdrafting of our water basin and the continued saltwater intrusion? The sewer project will not address all of these problems. Please tell the Los Osos community, where is the transparency of all of these questions? We do not get answers, and we are entitled, and those particularly in the prohibition zone and the assessment district that are paying for this. We need some answers. Please give them to us or take action or do both. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Mike Brown, followed by, it looks like, Gary Freeberg.
Mike Brown, representing CoLab. Tomorrow evening, Wednesday, April 25th at 6 p.m. is a very important meeting. The county consultant Echo Northwest is going to present some preliminary information about its study on some of the impacts of the smart growth initiative. It's interesting, in the announcement of that meeting, it says the subject of the preliminary findings will include, one, if the county decides to place limitations on growth in rural areas, comma, how much growth will it shift to urban areas? It's a strange statement at this point when you've already adopted the whole commanding smart growth overarching policy. In your role at the APCD, you adopted the greenhouse gas thresholds, which are just full of stuff about concentrating people and favoring that kind of development. You made the TDCs mandatory. You adopted a climate action plan, which is full of ideas about how to concentrate growth and so forth. And now You've done all that, obviously, without ever answering the key question that's posed here, and the question of how that affects the environment and specifically the requirements of CEQA, because you can't do all those things without doing that, and you never did that, and that's one reason CoLab sued the county and is still pursuing that suit. And here is the admission in public in writing on your agenda that you never...
President of Los Osos Baywood Park for just about 25 years. During that time, I've been the chair and co-chair of LOCAC. I was appointed by former supervisor Bud Laurent to an economic advisory committee, and I'm currently an appointee on the finance advisory committee for the Los Osos CSD. I'm not here to defend any group. I'm not here to criticize you guys. I'm not here to get attention for myself. The reason that I'm here is a few weeks ago, I put up a petition on change.org, and since then I've had about 300 signatures from a cross-section of people. You've been getting the copies of the signed emails. It's a cross-section of families, of retirees, of individuals who have signed the petition not out of concern for hardship for themselves, but for a broader issue of San Luis Obispo County. According to Supervisor Gibson's figuring, the Los Osos sewer is going to cost the households, almost 5,000 households, about $165 a month. Well, county has multiplied those numbers out and have estimated, forecast, that there's going to be $10 million lost of consumer spending because the money is going to be redirected. Instead of spending $50 to go out to dinner or go shopping or do a little entertainment, people are going to have to say, well, let's take that money and we have to set it aside because we have to pay for our sewer assessment. Well, if you ask average economists what the multiplier effect is on that, because if a Los Osos couple gets paid on Friday night, they go out to dinner, then the restaurant has cash flow, the cook gets paid, the waitress gets paid, the waitress gets tips, maybe she goes out shopping the next day, if that store owner gets paid. So there's a 1.5 to 1.9 multiplier effect of this lost consumer spending. So we're looking at annually for the next 30 to 40 years, the terms of the loan, of $15 to $19 million being taken out of our county, not just Los Osos. Los Osos doesn't have a lot of restaurants and shopping. We go elsewhere. We go to Pismo. We go to Paso. We go to Rio Grande. We go all over and spend our money. And so the impact is on jobs, on job stability, on job creation, on businesses, and then what the lost tax revenues to schools and to public services because of this forecast loss of economic spending. And that's if it comes in exactly as Supervisor Gibson has said, at about $166 a month. As you know, as you've authorized, Pablo Ogren now can write a $150,000 check without getting your approval. So there can be all kinds of adjustments that will ripple down and have a greater impact on the assessments to the Los Osos residents. So my main concern is, what can you do? What can you do to assure job stability, job creation, and replace lost tax revenues to schools and public works that's going to happen because of the lost $10 million at least spending by Los Osos residents? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Freiberg. My next request to speak is Lindy Owen, followed by Ben DeFada.
Good morning, Lindy Owen from the beautiful community of Los Osos, where the nitrates are average and the saltwater intrusion is a nightmare. The last speaker pretty much summed it up, and I think he put a request out to you. What are you five supervisors able to do for Los Osos? I brought it up many times. You need to actually pull this project, reevaluate, question what happened to the lower cost project, and I believe we have a chance to go there. We've wasted 6.5 years, $13,666,000, and $627,000 so far with Mr. Pablo Ogren's project. From my experience, it's a bogus project. It's a Cadillac that isn't needed. It's going to break when we have an earthquake. It's going to leak raw sewage into our septic tank or into our last drinking supply. An example of why a sewer in Los Osos isn't good is this is the statewide sanitary sewer overflow reduction project. And You can't see it, but in this map, it's just the whole coast and all of California is covered with areas that have incidents. These are spillage. Septic tanks don't spill and pollute waterways. They don't do those kinds of things, except individually. A sewer is a collection of an entire community, and when they break, it's the entire community's waste that is going, pumping out thousands, hundreds of thousands of gallons of liquid. When they break underground, you don't see them. The STEP project was always the preferred project. It was preferred in every single report. Why did Mr. Ogren choose to go with a big gravity sewer? What is his connection with Montgomery Watson Harza, who is being charged with corruption in four other major cities in the United States? Why are we doing business with a corrupt corporation?
Yale made the cover of the New Times again, where reporter Colin Wrigley did a masterful job of reporting again. It could be a blessing for him, or a curse, or a hall of fame, or a hall of shame. I really take exception again for what was said by Supervisor Hill about us. In short, he accused us of showing up here every week because we thrive on attention. He should have said we thrive on deaf ears. Believe me, Chairman Patterson, I'm not here for my health. In fact, as you have seen, I'm not a public speaker, and I'm very nervous being here speaking before you and the public. Last week, someone accused us of having to read our comments instead of looking you five in the eyes. It was just a few weeks ago some of you were reading your iPads. Pretty hard to look in your iPad in your eyes when you're looking at iPads. I have to read what I say because my memory is way down due to my age, I guess. Who would have thought that I and others would be here week after week for 5-6 years trying to tell you we don't need Mr. Gibson's unaffordable gravity sewer project? In the past, we have seen some of you cut down our speaking time, admonished us, put fear into public speakers by having the sheriff here week after week. These are tactics desperate people use when they are doing something wrong. You're supposed to represent the best interests of all those in the zone, not just a few that can afford your damn sewer. Believe me, we don't come here week after week to thrive on attention. We're trying to right a very serious wrong that Gibson and Ogren are trying to get away with their flawed project that has no business being built on the conditions and obstacles that Los Osos has. These obstacles are slowly coming out in the open and will be costly to rectify later. Have you forgotten that we, the people, have the right to tell you when you are wrong? It's easy to see that you are all beholden to each other through thick and thin like well-lubricated gears. With the upcoming elections, you too should be scared because your constituents in your districts are being informed of what you are doing to us. I'm sure they will think twice before voting. And let me go down the line here. Way back then, say 20 years ago, Noel King and Pablo Ogren, Pandora and Pablo Ogren, Shirley Bianchi, and now Mr. Gibson and Pablo Ogren again are going to saddle us with this unaffordable, flawed, energy hog, not-so-green, sludge-maker, gravity-collection sewer project that very few can afford. When Senator Blakesley, AB 2701, was written, the bill aced out the Los Osos, CSD, and other committees to be silent. So, let's see. If we divide the numbers above number, has any of you divided $200 million by 4,600 properties? It does not come out to $25,000 per unit, as was said to this board property owners in the past.
Thank you, Mr. DePata.
Lowballing.
Thank you, Mr. DePata. Eric Greening, followed by Al Barrow.
Thank you. Good morning. I am Eric Greening, and I hope you all had a happy Earth Day. Of course, every day is Earth Day and continues to be, and I want to thank those of you who showed up last Thursday when there were staff from the State Lands Commission here having a public session on the EIR that is currently out relative to the work to be done supposedly to gather information, better information on the fault structures that could threaten the plant. I realize, and I want to especially thank Mr. Gibson and Mr. Hill, because I saw them in the afternoon session. I'm not sure who may or may not have shown up for the evening session, but certainly showing the interest of being there is a good thing. And I know that there is a time pressure being applied by PG&E. They have ceded a lot of time that they, you know, they've already been somewhat slowed down on this. And I'm hoping that the county, which I know is not the lead agency, but is a responding agency, will do everything possible to make time not the issue. We're talking about a license that doesn't expire for more than a decade. I know all of you individually drive, and I wonder how people would feel if you had a driving test today for a renewal of your license that would be good from the day you turn 75 until the day you turn 95. We know that you can take a driving test today and learn that you'll be doing just fine at age 95. That's basically what time pressure on this thing is about. And the speakers here brought up some very substantial issues, both in terms of the inadequacy of the faults being looked at onshore and the horrific impacts of the testing offshore.
Good morning. My name is Al Merrill, Coalition for Low Income Housing. Today we have Hilocchio the puppet. This is a play on Pinocchio's truth concerns with his puppet, Geppetto's puppet, Pinocchio. And we have a nose here that elongates when the truth is not being told. The first thing I want to explain is this is a deposition format. The testimony of a witness that is reduced to writing for later use in court for discovery purposes. That's basically what a deposition means. As a witness, the binding nature of the promise of telling the truth in the statement of facts is basic underlying principle of this process. Willfully delivering a false oath is a crime of perjury. So, did you understand that? Okay. We're moving forward here. Just a second. Let me change my screen a little bit. Okay. Hilocchio, did you understand the mission statement? I know that you were the of the project. I know that you were the chair during the due diligence process here of the board. You did understand that? Okay. The mission statement is to evaluate and develop a wastewater treatment system for Los Osos in cooperation with the community water purveyors to solve the level 3 water resources shortage and groundwater pollution in an environmentally sensitive and sustainable and cost-effective manner while respecting community preferences and promoting participatory government and addressing individual affordability challenges to the greatest extent possible. Did you do that? Have you accomplished that goal? Out with the nose. Okay, that didn't happen. The assessment promised competitive bidding between low pressure and gravity collection. That's not happening. Is that correct? Okay. Your project is described as a $189 million project, plus the existing sewer assessment of $19 million, which you continually ignore, but we have to pay every year. The promised step-steg competition between gravity and step would have reduced the cost of the project. I said no. Well, that's not exactly true. About one quarter of the cost would be a SEPS state collection system. So all in all, I would just like to thank you for listening to our puppets, and we'll be back again next week.
Thank you. Jennifer Stover. And this is my last request to speak on public comment. Ms. Stover, I want to thank you for coming in this morning. We got through our consent calendar rather quickly, and we're on general public comment. I know you are here to speak on one of the items from consent, which is fine.
So. Right. Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much for letting me speak. And many of you seem to have been to many of these meetings before. This is my first time. I'm pretty nervous. But I did want to be here today. I wanted to represent the Birth and Baby Resource Network in thanking the Board of Supervisors for their proclamation on midwifery, and to receive that for all of the midwives in our community, and to invite the Board of Supervisors and anybody listening to join with us for a historic event happening in San Luis Obispo on May 5th, Saturday, in Mission Plaza. We are going to be celebrating the first International Day of the Midwife here in San Luis Obispo County. And we are trying to gather as many of the midwives, past and present, as possible to join us in this celebration. And so far, we have made contact with 41 midwives who have served the women of San Luis Obispo County and their families in a variety of settings, some of them in homes, some of them in healthcare offices, some of them in hospitals, some of them in birth centers. And I can't begin to stress how important these women and their care have been and the impact that they have made for the families of San Luis Obispo County over the last 40 years. And we are thrilled, the Birth and Baby Resource Network, to be able to sponsor this midwifery project and to encourage everyone in the county to come out and celebrate these wonderful women and all that they do, and to get online and register for supervisors will come out and join us for that event. Thank you.
Ms. Stover, can you give the website address?
Oh, yes.
To register, please?
It's www.bbrn for Birth and Baby Resource Network. Thank you for
that. And that's .org?
.org.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much. Glad you were able to come in this morning.
Me too.
Thank you. Yes. Supervisor Meacham.
Yeah, just quickly, and you're absolutely right about the midwives. I have three of my grandchildren were born with midwives out on the ranch, and 1 week before the first one was born, my daughter had to call the midwife because her sister-in-law was going to deliver a baby at the ranch. She delivered that baby with the help of the midwife on the phone. So I'll have three grandchildren that are very healthy and with the assistance of those midwives. So that was a tremendous thing to see. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Supervisor Meacham. And as I have already stated, my son was born at home with two midwives in attendance, and so it was a wonderful experience for us.
And one other thing, if I could,
yes.
Mr. Chairman, this weekend, Saturday, there's going to be a fashion show. That's going to be held at the Robert Hall Winery at 11 o'clock, where I think your legislative assistant and mine as well will be in fashion models.
And swimsuits, I'm told. Is that right?
Pardon?
In swimsuits?
I don't know about that. I tried to get Supervisor Patterson in a dress, but I just couldn't quite make that work. But this is for the Templeton Library fundraiser. And so if you have an opportunity, you want to buy tickets, contact either of our legislative assistants. They'll be happy to help you out.
Very good. Thank you, Supervisor Meacham. Thank you, Ms. Stover, again, for coming in this morning. You did a great job at being your first time and all. Okay, with that, we will close general public comment and go on to the next item on our agenda. And if Madam Clerk would read that item, please.
That item would be number 11, submittal of the 2011 Annual Agricultural Report.
Okay, very good. And we have our Ag Commissioner, Marty Sedevendemi, here, along with our Deputy Ag Commissioner, Brenda Auerkirk, to make the presentation. Marty?
Well, thank you, Chairman Patterson and Supervisors. My name is Marty Sedevendemi, Agricultural Commissioner, and today I'm very pleased to bring you all good news. We're looking at...
That's the kind of news we like to hear, Marty. So
as kind as you want.
Oh, great. We're looking at the 2011 calendar year crop statistics. And before I get into the actual numbers, I was going to go over some of the background of our crop reporting. This is a mandate of each California Ag Commissioner. We're required by law to present crop statistics to the Secretary of Food and Agriculture each year by April. And we have done that this year. And I wanted to emphasize that the values that we present do not represent, or they are representing gross values and not net profit to the agriculturalists within the county. And we do maintain confidentiality of all the information that we receive from our agriculturalists. We do use a very standardized format in our presentation to the secretary. We provide the crop types that are grown in the county, the acreage, overall yield or production, and then we place an overall gross value on those products. And we tend to categorize. We have quite a few crops that are produced, so we categorize those crops into five categories. Those are the animal commodities, fruit and nut, field crops, nursery products, and vegetable crops. So that's just kind of a little background on what we do, and now I'll kind of get into the overall valuation. So in 2011, values did reach a level of $736,208,000, and that is a new record for San Luis Obispo County. And although that we're seeing a lot of economic turmoil in the world, agriculture has remained very stable in our county. And not only do we have quite a bit of production, but we have quite a bit of variety in our county. We produce well over 100 different crops, and as we look at that, if we see a drop in one market, we might see a rise in another. So that balances our system, and we stay pretty consistent overall, and as you can see from the trend over the past 2 years, we are increasing in value. And that helps to keep our county ranked about 15th in the state of California. And considering that California is the fifth largest producer in the world of agricultural commodities, I think that's pretty significant. So we'll go on to the next one, Ryan. So this slide kind of shows the various categories that we report on. And you can see that there's quite a bit of fluctuation in the top two lines. That's the fruit and nut category on top, reaching $370 million in 2000 crops. This category, we also saw another record high. We were up 22% from the previous year to $22.9 million. What we saw in this category is that there was a general shortage nationwide of various grains, and that helped to push prices up higher. And we saw generally about $100 per ton increase in prices. And that helped to offset some of the lower yields that we saw within the category for 2011. And it's interesting, even though we had really good rainfall in 2011, our growers were telling us that the timing of that rain was not necessarily good for production. So we did have some lower yields overall in the category. Our next category is fruit and nuts, and the fruit and nut category reached $370 million for the year, and we do have a new number one crop this year. It is strawberries. A little explanation on that. But strawberries, we saw an increase in acreage of about 741 acres. That pushed up production. We had very strong yields and very strong prices for that crop. Wine grapes were a different story. Wine grapes had a little bit of a problem during the year. We experienced freezing temperatures in April of 2011, and that pushed production down about 34%. But the saving grace when it comes to wine grapes is that there was about a 3% lower yield statewide for wine grapes, and that pushed prices up. So we saw across the board varietal prices ranging anywhere from 2 to 22% higher. So that kind of saved us from even slumping down lower in that category. Moving on to nursery stock. So the nursery production overall was up about 2%. Over the past 10 years, it's taken quite a hit after the recession in 2008, and that's related primarily to the housing market. And our outdoor ornamental crops, sod, outdoor plants, bedding plants, they've taken quite a hit over the past couple years. But where we have found stability is with our vegetable transplants and our indoor decoratives. So that's maintained a pretty stable line over the past couple years. And I did want to mention that in our nursery production, we do have a very viable export market. And a lot of our products do go to different countries. Canada is one of our biggest trading partners. Let's go ahead. So vegetable crops. We have seen a little bit of a decline over the years. And this is interesting. What's happening here is historical vegetable ground is being converted little by little over to strawberries. And when you look at it face value, an acre of strawberries can yield $56,000, whereas an acre of vegetables maybe $6,000 or $7,000. So there's where you're seeing that incentive to move over. But we'll look into the future. We'll see what happens. If there may be more conversion, who knows? But definitely strawberries are a very high-dollar crop, and there's a lot of incentive to move that way. Moving on, this is just a rundown of our top 20 crops. You can see strawberries are number one. That's the first time strawberries have ever been number one. Wine grapes fell to number two after sitting on top for 20 years. Cattle and calves remain very strong. Broccoli is still one of our major exports as far as a vegetable crop. Vegetable transplants remain very strong, followed by indoor decoratives, cut flowers, head lettuce. And avocados, we had a little bit of a downturn in 2011. Some of the weather conditions were not conducive to crop production, so we did see lower yields. And then ending the top 10 with rangeland grazed. And then from 11 down to 20, Napa cabbage, lemons, celery, bell peppers, outdoor ornamentals, cauliflower, leaf lettuce, cabbage, grain, and alfalfa hay. And just some closing remarks, I do want to thank all of our farmers and ranchers for providing this information. We do keep this information confidential, and they're really the key to letting us know what the trends are throughout the year, why these ebbs and flows are occurring, how weather conditions are impacting their crops. So they've been a real key component to the success of this and the accuracy of this report. And I'd also like to thank my staff, who takes a lot of time in going through this data, compiling it, and making heads and tails of it. So they've done a great job, and I really appreciate that. And finally, we do have a hard copy that comes out each year in June. We will make that available in each of our offices, which are in Florida, is that every citrus-producing county in Florida has found the psyllid as well as the disease, and production has gone down about 50%. So what we're trying to do right now is prevent that insect from coming into San Luis Obispo County. It already occurs in multiple Southern California counties, and the disease has just been detected in Los Angeles County. So right now we're gearing up. We usually deploy about 450 insect traps for this particular pest alone. We're probably at about 4,500 traps throughout the county for all of the pests that we look for. So this is something that we're very concerned about. We're working very hard to keep out. And if there's one thing that I could ask from the public is that they're very careful about moving plants from area to area. If they go out of San Luis Obispo County and they pick up a plant someplace, please contact one of the ag departments, whether it's in another county or our county, and let us take a look at that plant. Let us make sure that it's going to be okay to bring in, that it's free from any pests or diseases.
Marty, can you name some other host plants? Are there other host plants that...
For the Asian citrus psyllid, it's mainly citrus.
It's only... Okay. Yeah. So if people purchase citrus out of the area, they should contact either our Ag Commissioner's office or wherever.
Or the Origin Ag Commission.
Okay, but yeah. Only citrus, not other ornamentals or things.
No, this is primarily a citrus pest.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Was there more that you had, or was that?
Oh, well, there's a lot more, but I think that's really.
Well, I do have some of my colleagues that have comments or questions, so hang in there. We'll start with Supervisor Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Marty, be interesting to see if all of a sudden we start making strawberry wine. That crop value will go way up there. Are we making any efforts to provide data for the multiplier effect of agriculture? I know that we've talked about this before.
We have talked about this before. I have not been contacted by Cal Poly, but I did provide my information, and we can, as a department, provide any of the statistics that we have. But I did anticipate this question. There is a study that was conducted by the University of California Agricultural Issues Center, and that study was completed in 2009, and it's called The Measure of California Agriculture. And this study looked at various regions throughout California, studied the economics of agriculture, and they did identify some multipliers. So the three multipliers that they identified for agricultural production and processing is for employment, 1.66, labor income, 1.85, and value added is 1.87. And I would refer anybody to that study or the people who conducted that study to answer any specific questions.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that, because I'm always fascinated by the crop reports, but I know that it goes much deeper than that in terms of the economy. So thank you. Appreciate
You're welcome.
That.
Good. Yeah, thank you, Marty, for that. That's good information. Supervisor Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Marty, I wonder, the citrus green, a couple questions. One, which does take up the citrus greening, because I had I think just last week in the New York Times, they had an article on this spreading in Southern California. And one of the things that, you know, that would be interesting to the public, and might be an opportunity for you to write a viewpoint for the Tribune, is that it not only will obviously have a potentially devastating effect on folks who produce citrus, you know, for our markets and such, but also the most common thing that people associate with California, and I know as somebody grew up in the East Coast, I used to love the idea that, you know, one day you could live in California and have your own lemon tree or your own orange tree in your yard, and that could sort of change something that's become just part of California culture. You know, people people used to, I mean, people come here and they love the fact that their relatives or their friends have fruit trees in their yard. Mm-hmm. And so I think that this has even a broader implication in terms of being very careful about what we do and how we can address this. So I would urge you, if you had time, to maybe point that out in some sort of fashion to alert the public to what they should be doing and not doing as well.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And we've been making efforts to do as much outreach as we can on this issue. We have put a press release out about a week or so ago, and we'll continue to do that, because the public is a major component here. That is one of the pathways that is the hardest to close. Right. We can monitor commercial movement of plants, but people going out of the area and bringing plants in is a significant pathway. Right. And you're right, it affects more than just commercial. It's our backyard, our landscapes, and that they're at risk.
Right. Okay. Well, good. I hope that gets more attention. And the other question.
We may rank 15th in the state, but in terms of variety, if you look at our top crops and even some of the secondary ones, we grow and produce a remarkable variety of agricultural products. And, you know, I think I know Supervisors Hill and Meacham have worked hard on the county's economic strategy. One of those clusters is uniquely slow, and our ag production is, I think, right in the middle as the pillar of the uniquely slow cluster of our, you know, of the prosperity of this county. I would like to add my voice to the thought that we're all in this together, that the way this works is for everybody in this county to participate in one way or another, whether it's buying local foods, or we have a robust farmers market culture here, which is to our benefit in a lot of different ways. But also for those in urban areas who may not feel directly connected with agriculture, your cooperation with our Ag Commissioner's office as they come by to do sample trapping. I know your staff is polite and educated and willing to inform, but I want to reach out to those of our urban residents who may not quite understand the import of what's going on. You do remarkably important work that benefits us all, and we'll look forward to taking on the challenges. You know, now that we've we know how much water we have for the coming growing season, we'll deal with that, and we'll move on to work on some other things.
Well, thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you, Supervisor Gibson. You're being very patient, Marty. So hang in there. We're almost
all right.
Supervisor Teixeira.
Thank you, Chairman Patterson, and Marty, I too thank you for the work that you've done here. And just a couple questions or comments. One of them yesterday, we were talking about the pest, and you mentioned that if they found a tree that was infested, they'd take it out and then monitor the surrounding trees. But I think something that's really important to me that you said yesterday is that this disease is not shown in like the first 2 years that the tree is infested, if I'm correct.
You're correct.
It could be 3 or 4 years before you find out, and once you find out, it's too late to do anything. And I think that's very important for the public to know. And the other thing is that it is a pest that could come back. So if you've got one tree that's infested and you take it out, the pest goes to your neighbors or down the roads and they can come back. It's not something once you start treating your trees that they'll just go away and disappear.
Correct, yeah. And the eradication method that's being employed down in Los Angeles County includes not only tree removal, but the treatment of any host plants within a certain radius around that plant, so that any insects that may have fed off of that infected plant will be eradicated, and then they can't move to other trees.
Okay, cool. So. And the other thing was on the crop report, what I'd like to see, and this is something you and I can talk about later, but a total of the field crops, because you have the wine industry, you have strawberry, you have cattle, but when you talk about lettuce, broccoli, cauliflower, and those type of crops, a lot of those are done in rotation on the same property, and I'd like to see the total of that contribution to the county.
Oh, as far as a vegetable category as a whole?
Right.
Okay.
And like I said, we can talk about that later.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Marty. And I want to just, again, emphasize one of the issues that Supervisor Gibson raised, and that is the diversity of agricultural products in this county. We're fortunate to live in a coastal county with inland environments and a wide range of climate and soils that really make that diversity and variety possible here. And the robust system of farmers markets that make those products available to the public in general, and the comment about the urban farmers, if you will, we've got a lot of those out there. We've got communities with community gardens and school gardens, and folks are really starting to understand the value of their food and where it comes from, and it's very important in a county where we advocate for good nutrition and good health, and we certainly have the opportunity here. And I want to put in a plug for your office mates, if I may, and that's the University of California Cooperative Extension, which runs the Master Gardener Program. And they have a garden there across the parking lot from your offices where they train people, and they have good exhibition and opportunity there for vegetable growing, and they also answer people's questions, as does your office. So
yes.
People can contact your office or the University of California Cooperative Extension Master Gardeners. So thank you, Marty, for being here. We always appreciate hearing from you, and we've got an open door. Anytime you have an issue, please come in and share it with us and the public.
So appreciate it. Thank you.
We're going to take a short 15-minute break and reconvene at 10:20.
Did you want to open the item for public comment?
Oh,
and I'll receive and
okay. I'm sorry. Okay.
Good morning, Emily Jackson from the Administrative Office. I'm going to provide you with a brief introduction to this next item. It's a joint item between the Planning Department and the Department of Social Services. Excuse me. Primarily a request to add a program manager to the Department of Social Services PAL to act as a sort of homeless services coordinator who will work with the Homeless Services Oversight Council. But in addition to that, and perhaps more importantly, we felt that bringing this item before your board would also be a good opportunity to have some discussion about HSOC activities up until this point, provide your board with an overview of some of the accomplishments of the HSOC in over the past several years, and provide for a more broad discussion of the county's increased focus on coordinating homeless services, which is exactly what this item is intended to do. So to do that, I have Dana Lilly from our Planning and Building Department, and then Lee Collins, our Director of Social Services, here to provide the update and discuss staffing of HSOC. And we also have Morgan Terrell from Planning, who will provide any background information or any of the details that anybody might be interested in. So with that, I will turn it over to Dana.
Very good. Thank you. Mr. Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dana Lilly with your planning staff. I get the middle part of the presentation, and then Lee will bat cleanup for us. And I'll give you some of the history of the county's involvement in homeless services. A lot of it's in the staff report. I won't go into too much detail about it. But we are quite a ways into a long evolution of the county's involvement. It wasn't that many years ago the county's involvement supporting homeless programs was fairly modest. There were nonprofits were getting grants on their own without county involvement, but that has changed, some of it because HUD pretty much dictated it. So to go back to the beginning, back in 2008 was a time when the county and its nonprofit partners recognized that we couldn't put off any longer preparation of a 10-year plan to address homelessness. HUD insisted that these plans all be called to end homelessness, so we named it that, but we didn't believe it would really end homelessness, but it could certainly make a big difference. Once that 10-year plan was created by probably over 200 local people working on it, the county staff and nonprofit partners presented that to all of the cities and the county, and all of which endorsed its guiding principles. It had a number of key features in it, but one of them was creation of a decision-making body or authority. And after lots and lots of public discussion, the consensus seemed to be, well, the county could create an advisory committee, and that entity could operate somewhat independently and give advice to the county, the cities, the nonprofit community about how to run homeless programs and how to design them. Moving on to 2009, the county followed up and created the Homeless Services Oversight Council, a formal advisory committee to the county with 24 members, very broad-based, elected representatives from every city and the county. There's the nonprofit community, service providers, the medical community, the faith community, and the business community, and others. With that large a group, it was a good forum for discussing a lot of issues, but the nitty-gritty work of figuring out how to change how homeless services are provided fell to these subcommittees that the HSOC created. And initially, those had certain names, but now they've evolved a little bit, and those four subcommittees are finance and data, housing, supportive services, and public awareness. And they're still functioning now. Some of the accomplishments that the HSOC can be credited with are listed in the staff report. One is a strong endorsement to create a supplemental security or SSI benefits advocacy program to essentially streamline how people who are eligible to get SSI get qualified for it, to have a public forum for discussing and then later to advocate creation of places where homeless people who have a vehicle can stay overnight and are safe, and we call them safe parking programs, and there's now a pilot started here in San Luis Obispo and one in Arroyo Grande as well. The mere fact of having the HSOC as a guiding entity for influencing how public resources are spent also contributed towards our competitiveness with some of HUD's homeless programs, specifically the supportive housing program. Um, It also provided a form, and this has been happening much more. That person was intended to be independent from the county, to be an independent voice. So very deliberately, the county found an agency that could act as a fiscal agent, turned out to be United Way, that would hold on to some small amount of monies that the county had secured to pay for this staff person. And then the United Way contracted with a person who was the executive director for the HSOC. And she did make quite a bit of difference. She helped out greatly when we were preparing our applications to HUD. She did lots of research and education for HSOC members and others. But at this point, she has declined to continue in that role, and now this has produced an opportunity for the county to take a breath and decide, well, how best should we address the need for staffing for HSOC and coordination for all of the agencies who are involved in homelessness services. A great deal of information was provided by our department to the administrative office about every option that you could imagine, everything from moving all of the HUD grants out of planning to social services to moving pieces of them, and our consensus ended up settling on the one that's proposed for you to consider today, and that is the half-time position that is already in social services to provide clerical support, post the agendas, do the minutes, those types of things, but add a higher-level program manager position to act as more of a leader and effectively that HSOC executive director. And in the background, during probably the last 6 or 7 years, I would say, the demands from HUD, and we're sure it's from Congress, on how much activity at a local level must be invested to keep those dollars coming in to serve the homeless has increased dramatically. It used to be a far smaller amount of the staff in the planning department that had to be dedicated to it, and it's grown a lot. I'll put it this way. These programs are now not fully self-sufficient. The county already has to put up some general fund money just to ensure we have enough staffing to address all of the things that HUD is insisting we address, and that's probably a big factor that's contributed to us being in front of you for today. And I think this is the point at which I hand the baton off to Mr. Collins.
Thank you. Good morning, Sean
Patterson. Is your mic on, Lee? There you go.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman Patterson, members. It's true that the half-time executive director got us to where we are today, and there's no question that tremendous progress was made. She pointed out, of course, that a great deal of her time was taken up by these administrative support tasks and scheduling meetings, preparing agendas and minutes and these kinds of things. And as Mr. Lilly pointed out, that, you know, in response to that, the Department of Social Services dedicated a half-time administrative assistant to provide that support. Since that time, that person who was serving in that position has left, and what we've looked at is these different options. We are requesting, based on conversations that we had with the administrative office and the other departments and with the approval of the Homeless Services Oversight Council itself, the addition of a full-time program manager, which is a mid-level manager position, to the Department of Social Services. And this individual will not be a homeless czar of any kind, is not going to be able to tell anybody what to do, but will provide facilitation, liaison services, and sort of oversight and assistance, support to the HSOC and to the other departments, nonprofits, cities, and others involved in the delivery of services to the homeless. Will be the lead facilitator for the continuum of care. As Mr. Lilly pointed out, any time that you accept money from the federal government, they impose a certain amount of bureaucracy upon you. That bureaucracy is required, and one always has to determine whether the bureaucracy is worth the funding, but in this case, there's no question that there's a significant amount of funding that's provided to the community by HUD, and it's important to meet their requirements. But there are other funds available besides HUD, grants that come down from different entities for various kinds of specialized services, whether they are for drug and alcohol or mental health or veteran services, prisoners who are returning to the community and who need some kind of support lest they end up homeless. There are different kinds of very specialized niche grants that are available, and as a community, we have not done all that we can to locate those and provide support in applying for them. Mr. Lilly pointed out the importance of the Homeless Management Information System, and while it is in place and data is being input into the system, there's still not enough. We still need support from other agencies, not the least of which is agencies of the county itself. We will be looking at improved implementation of the Homeless Management Information System. This is the workhorse of data that HUD demands from us and that I think our community should expect in terms of improved data and good information. Again, I mentioned the bureaucratic requirements that HUD imposes around the continuum of care. We need someone to sort of shepherd that and guide that. The next series of funding options that are coming up, we need to plan and be prepared for, and we expect this individual to take the charge there. And as I mentioned, the next enumeration of the homeless community is coming up this coming January, which is not that far away, and we need to begin planning right away. My expectation is that this individual will be quite visible. This is someone who's going to have to be comfortable in business attire and be comfortable talking with people in the creek beds. This is someone who's going to need to be able to address the concerns of the business community as well as concerns of the homeless individuals themselves. So we're looking for someone who's going to be very talented in many ways, and there is no individual who's sort of pegged or in line or we know of who's applying for this or who's in line, and so I would appreciate you giving me this opportunity to urge anyone who's interested to apply by this Friday, which I believe would be the filing deadline.
And how do they do that, Mr.
Thank you for that question, Supervisor Patterson. They do that by going to the County of San Luis Obispo website, to the Human Resources Department, and look on jobs available, and it will be found there. And if anyone has trouble doing that, they can call me, and I'll walk them to the site.
Very good. Thank you.
So with that, the staff's recommendation is that the board receive and file the report on HSOC activities over the past several years and then approve the resolution to add one FTE program manager to the Department of Social Services PAL. So that's, I think, concludes the presentation. If the board has any questions, we're happy to entertain those.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Jackson. Supervisor Hill wants to comment, and then I would like to follow him with some comments as well. Supervisor Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Lee and Dana and Emily, for the report. A couple of things, and I want to, if I can, touch on some of the things that Lee said that I think are important. Certainly the data, I should clarify that I served as HSOC chair for a couple of years and handed it off to Supervisor Patterson, who's currently doing it, and I'm grateful for that. Certainly the data collection is, the HMIS is a very important component of this because, as you pointed out, Lee, the enumeration really is just such a small snapshot and hard to really infer some of the things that we're seeing in the community now. For instance, we are seeing certainly more intensity of homeless folks who are mentally ill and might also be connected with that addiction problems, people who are, we're seeing them in our downtown, we're seeing them in certain areas throughout cities, and it's caused quite a problem, I think. And so I'm hoping that one of the things that we can focus on, I think that all of us are aware that the biggest challenge with a lot of homeless folks is the mental health and the drug and alcohol outreach part of it. And I know it's Mr. Hamm's department that is ultimately responsible for this, but I really think that we need a greater just a greater effort on mental health outreach with homeless folks, including at the day center, the shelter, at Echo, even at the People's Kitchen down in Grover Beach, and drug and alcohol as well, because as we have had community meetings with some of the people in the business community in regards to the new proposed homeless services center, there is much greater concern right now than there had been even 3 years ago when we were first moving forward on it. And I think that even in the urban corridor of the city here, there is just a greater intensity of problems that are occurring for a lot of folks that, you know, we all would agree are really not tolerable for anybody, to businesses and others alike. And so it is going to require, obviously, a very talented person, but I really think that the what we see often from the people who are the most difficult to address problems with, and often the people who are creating the problems that businesses and residents are experiencing, are people who are suffering from mental illness and suffering from drug and alcohol addiction. And I think that we really need to beef up that as much as we can. And so those are just comments, but I really think that what HSOC can do and what this new program can do in a way that becomes more more present in the community.
Those agency and service organization representatives, nonprofits, staff members from cities and the county, working with the facilitator to develop the 10-year plan to end homelessness. From that effort, in order to be successful, we decided how to take that next step, or how best to take that next step to implement that 10-year plan. And I, along with Lee Collins and others, sat on a committee that basically formed the HSOC and got that organization established. And as Mr. Lilly commented, went out and engaged the cities and asked for their help and funding, someone that would actually carry this forward under the guidance of HSOC. And as you've heard, HUD is continually changing its requirements. And if we are going to do any more than we're doing today, and that's really just addressing the chronic issues, if we're really going to advance the program, we need to take this next step. And I strongly feel that what's being recommended today is that essential next step. If we're going to implement the homeless management information system, if we're going to provide for the continuum of care, if we're going to have a governance body that HUD is requiring to implement these programs, then we absolutely need to take this next step. And I especially want to thank the admin office, who's been participating the last many months in moving this idea forward, Jim Grant and his staff, Jason Giffen, Morgan Terrell, and Dana Lilly from Planning and Building are essential to really the success of the future here, I think, because they've been working with the requirements of HUD and are the ones that really have the basic information to meet their criteria. And then, of course, Lee Collins, who from the very beginning has been instrumental in shaping this whole program, and now he stepped up and is offering us the opportunity through his department with the supportive admin to take that next essential step. And in addition to those individuals, I want to thank Patricia Gomez, who worked for a year as our executive director and did an awful lot on her own time under her own initiative to get us where we need to be, to get us to this point. And also my legislative assistant, Amy Gilman, who has a passion for this kind of work and has really stepped up and filled gaps when gaps appeared to help us make progress and move forward. And she's been a great mentor for me on the issues before us and the complexity of the system, and it is very complex. And without people like them and like Lee and Morgan and Dana, we wouldn't be where we are today. So I just want to thank all of them and the people involved from the community, from our other cities, and from the service organizations and nonprofits. The HSOC, which I now chair, we did have a strategic planning session back in October setting some goals for 2012 because we want to see progress. Participants want to see measurable progress, and we're beginning to implement those goals this year. One of those, as you all probably know, there are three regional efforts underway, the Five Cities Homeless Coalition in South County, the Community Action Partnership, which runs the Maxine Lewis Memorial Shelter here as well as Prado Road, and then the El Camino Homeless Organization in the North County. They're all working on their individual regional projects. They're all in the process of embarking on fund development campaigns, and we wanted to be sure that we're all working together, that we're not competing for the same resources, that our ultimate goal is to address the homeless issues countywide. And so we brought those folks together in January, and we'll be meeting quarterly to ensure that all of our efforts aren't competitive but collaborative, and that's an important thing that HSOC is embarking on currently. So thank you to all of you folks, and we did receive a request to speak, so I'll open it to the public and invite Mr. Greening to the podium for comments, and then we'll bring it back to the board for action.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and I appreciate the work that's going on. I will say, as someone who walks and uses the bus, I probably have more conversations with members of our homeless community than people who habitually travel in their personal vehicles. And members of the homeless community that I talk to don't yet see the 10-year plan making a physical difference in their lives. They don't see their lives becoming easier. What am I giving up in terms of personal autonomy or dignity in getting help? And so I want to speak to some converging efforts here. I know that volunteers from Cal Poly are working at the Sunny Acres site, but even beyond that, that may not be the most appropriate site. There's a group of people inspired by Dignity Village in Portland who are looking for basically land for a self-governing community of people whose primary need is simply emergency shelter. And that can actually, if there's cooperation in having such a place, shelter itself can be achieved at least on an emergency short-term basis, quite cheaply. A word that both could get you a lot of points in Scrabble and be fun to look up is hexayurt, just as an example of some of the designs that are out there if you have a place to do it. Hexayurt. But it raises the question, are there ways we can have something like that in place? Most of the ones I'm speaking to don't have vehicles. The ones that I encounter on foot and on the bus, they need more than a parking space, but they need emergency shelter. Can we get something in place by next winter? We have a few warmer months in front of us now where people won't simply be dying of exposure, but that will come soon enough. Cool. Are there ways we can actually have options for shelter besides the shelter beds, which, as we know, don't come near to meeting the needs of 3,800 people? Thank you.
Yes, very good. Thank you, Mr. Greening. Supervisor Gibson.
I'll yield to Supervisor Hill, who wanted to respond to Mr. Greening.
Yeah, if I could, and I think Eric makes some good points, but I did want to point out, and I think when I was bringing up the need to see greater coordination and greater outreach from mental health and drug and alcohol, you know, if you volunteer at the shelter or the overflow, whether it be here in San Luis or up in Echo, the need for emergency shelter is not nearly the same need as there is for the services that would get people into shelter. There's quite a lot of people who, because of their illness, and often that is accompanied by addiction problems, who are not seeking shelter. They're not coming into the shelters or the overflow shelters for whatever reasons. They may not be actually even applying for the safe parking programs that are establishing too. I mean, what everybody agrees that works with homelessness is that the main theme is self-sufficiency, is helping people get back on their feet and helping people live as independently as possible. And that usually addresses the range of concerns that any community might have with homeless folks. And so I think that it's important to understand that that is always the toughest part of it, is providing, especially at a time when so much has been cut back, but those kinds of services are essential. And just to follow up on that while I'm on the subject, the warming station that we have, that our board and the city helps to keep open on very bad weather days, will be open tomorrow when there's an expected rainstorm at Prado, and they do need, as they often do, volunteers and people to provide dinners. Because on rainy nights, of course, when it's particularly miserable, I think Prado will stay open through the night and will have as many as 40 or 50 folks, and that's not typically something they do, and so volunteers and dinners are needed, and you can contact the Prado Day Center, which is in the phone book, if you'd like to help out. The other thing I wanted to touch on that Supervisor Patterson reminded me is that on May 2nd, there will be a panel discussion here in the Board of Supervisors, May 2nd, this chamber, from 6 to 8. They will show a couple of videos, one that some folks have heard about that was in the film festival and has been shown up at Atascadero at Echo, the Homeless Not Helpless video that was funded by HSOC and is part of the outreach and education. That will be shown. There will also be a video shown that was, I think, produced by Capslow, to give an overview of some of the things that they do and need. And then there'll be a panel discussion of homeless service providers from South County, SLO, and North County also, and I'll be hosting that. So if you want to find out more, see these videos, or ask questions, or express some concerns that because I do think that we're seeing many more, much more intensity in relating to the homeless issue in our community, and much more people, many more questions I'm getting, I know myself. May 2nd would be a good opportunity to come and learn some more and also ask questions and give some feedback. So hope you can come to that. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, thank you, Supervisor Hill. I do want to mention that the event we held at Echo in a time.
But I think we're starting to see a direction. I'm supportive of what's before us today. But I'd like to suggest that this is really just a small first step in a number of things that need to be done. Mr. Collins referenced the wide range of duties that the specific position that we're contemplating today might undertake, and that's good. Beyond the question of gathering data or being a liaison between business interests and the homeless service providers and the homeless community, what I am hopeful of seeing here is a new sense of leadership that's going to be concentrated within the county organization. That policy being set by this board, and I'm encouraged that Mr. Collins and the Department of Social Services is taking on increased responsibilities here, because I think it will allow us to sharpen our focus. And as commenters have pointed out, addressing the many facets of this is going to take a wide range of individuals within the county, not only the board, but admin, DSS, the health agency, the Planning and Building Department. And I'm hopeful that we are starting to move forward with a coordinated approach. I think that what we need to do is really demonstrate outstanding leadership both within the county organization and outside. And to that end, I would suggest that our team working on this might plan to be back before this board in, let's say, 6 months or so, and on a periodic basis thereafter. But 6 months to me strikes me as the start of the next winter season with a little bit of lead time. And let us know what's happening, because we've got a lot of individuals and a lot of organizations that are going to be part of the solution. And I'd like to hear how things are being coordinated. I'd like to hear what new ideas and new results we might expect to see in this coming winter season of 12-13 that we know will once again be difficult.
my thoughts and be supportive of the
motion. I appreciate that, Supervisor Gibson. And one of the things that we plan to do at HSOC is give the board periodic updates. After all, we are an advisory committee, so we do expect to come back before this board with updates. And also, I think for the first time this year, the HSOC also made recommendations for the CDBG funding and emergency solutions grant and some of the others, working with Morgan and Dana and also Tony Navarro to actually weigh in on how the funding that we have available for homeless is allocated, and that's one of their roles. Supervisor Meacham.
I'll be very brief.
Okay.
I'm going to follow up to Supervisor Gibson's comments. I would like to see more detailed benchmarks that you expect to try to reach in this whole program. And it's always interesting that we can all of a sudden find money to do this. So I'm anxious to see where we're going with from a benchmark standpoint.
Very good. Thank you. Ms. Taylor, did you want to comment? I don't have a request to speak.
No, I was going to ask Mr. Collins to please put out over the air a contact phone number, which he did not do, and there may be some applicant out there who would like to have that phone number. Please ask him to put it on the air. Thank you.
We will do that. Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Mr. Collins, can you oblige us with a contact phone if for those that may not have access to Internet?
No. In fact, I can't. It would be the main number of our HR department, and I can't think off the top of my head what it is.
I believe it's 805-781-5959. That should be the front desk receptionist who can forward you to the appropriate person handling, who will be handling this recruitment.
And the clerk is nodding, suggesting that that is a good number.
excellent number.
I yes.
781-5959.
We have Ms. Jackson and Ms. Christensen here for a reason. And that's it. So, Supervisor Hill, you are back up.
Yeah, I'm not sure if we're ready for a motion.
I'll close it to public comment. I have no more requests to speak, so... Supervisor Hill, if you'd like to make a motion, I think
yeah,
that
and would I would also I'd also like to echo Mr. Gibson and Mr. Meacham's thoughts. I
there
do
you
think, you know, there is a certain kind of nebulous quality to what we're all trying to do ultimately, and it's really important to have some very specific benchmarks, as Mr. Meacham pointed out, and that we can show. You know, what we've accomplished beyond even the important things like data collection and coordination, which, you know, is obviously critical but not everything that we really need. Right now, I think when we hear from the community is that we need to do as best as we can in the toughest.
Very good. Thank you. And, again, I want to reemphasize the role that planning and building plays in this effort as well. With the data collection and all that they do administering the grants. And so they have a very important role, and I want to thank Mr. Giffen, who is here, for, you know, giving his staff the opportunity and ability to do that, because without them, it certainly wouldn't happen. Mr. Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to respond to one point that Eric Greening made. As usual, Eric brings up good issues. And it is a very valid issue, and we keep getting reminded by our nonprofit partners that the homeless cannot be simply categorized in simply. They're very diverse. And HUD is recognizing that as well, so a portion of some of the grants we administer can be used for people who aren't mentally ill or substance abusing and are just a victim of the economy. So perhaps they need a deposit to get back into housing or a payment to not lose their housing. In those cases, they may not need intense case management. It may be just as simple as a quarterly check-in to see how are you addressing your barriers to housing, and then that's it. So it doesn't need to be demeaning or have them feel like a loss of dignity.
Right. Thank you for bringing that up.
Okay. With that, Mr. Chairman, if I may, I will move that we do approve the recommended action this is a sort of receive and file on the report, but then adopt a resolution amending the position allocation for Fund Center 180 Social Services to add one FTE program manager with the very specific, I think, concerns for very specific reporting 6 months hence.
Second.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded that we approve staff's recommendation. Madam Clerk, a roll call, please.
Mr. Hill.
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes. And thank you all.
Thank
Excellent
you.
Report. So with that, we'll move on to the next item. While we have a change in staff here, I'll ask the clerk to introduce that item, please.
That would be item 13, a request for authorization to process a land use element amendment application, LRP 2007-00015 by Templeton Community Services District to change the land use category from agriculture to public facilities on a 23-acre parcel.
Thank you. Ms. Foos, I guess you're going to be the lead staff person, or would it be Ms. Griffin?
I think I'm up.
Okay.
Good morning, Chairman, members of the board, Stephanie Foos, County Planning. The item I have for you is the reauthorization of a general plan amendment for the Templeton Community Services District on a 23-acre parcel. The request is to go from agriculture to public facilities. The project is located on Creekside Ranch Road, adjacent to the community of Templeton. I did want to say that originally this project was authorized in 2008. It came before the board. It did have a public park as part of the project description. And earlier this year, the TCSD amended the project description to only include the existing well site, a fire training facility, a possible water and wastewater treatment plant, and possibly other utility facilities on the site. So currently, this is the site here. It's in the agriculture land use category. The Salinas River here borders it here to the east. And the Pacific Railroad is on the west of the site. And this is an aerial view of the site. This is the site here. And here are some site photos. This is on Creekside Ranch Road, looking east, going towards the site. This is the railroad crossing. And this is a view of the site looking southwest. Creekside Ranch Road would be going this way. And this is a view of the existing well site looking east on the property. And this is a view looking south. So the primary issues here are site access with the at-grade railroad crossing. The primary focus would be to lessen public trips going across that railroad crossing. The other is the ag policies, which the referral from the ag department was inadvertently left out of your packet, but it has been made available to the public and to the board members.
Back in 2007-ish, and but there were conditions put on the annexation request, and that was basically that the land be placed in a permanent ag conservation easement or that a general plan amendment be completed to change the category. LAFCO typically is not supportive of annexing of agricultural land into a CSD boundary. And so the conditions of that original annexation were never complied with. It's since expired. And so part of the driver for this request is the change in the general plan to then allow it to be the property to be annexed into the CSD. The concern that the Ag Department has raised relative to the conversion policies in the ag element are even more applicable with the idea that this will be potentially annexed into the CSD. So if your board chooses to authorize this, we've got some work ahead of us with working with the Ag Department and the applicant to determine if any mitigation is actually even available or able to be completed. Otherwise, you may see us back here with a request to prepare a focused EIR, looking at ag conversion as the single issue. I just wanted to provide a heads up to both your board and the applicant of that. And that would be all.
Okay. Ms. Griffin, though, while you're on that subject, can you speak to the process and doing that, let's say, in the event you do the analysis for a general plan amendment and you find that there are potentially environmental issues or policy issues involved with that, and you come back and recommend that we do a focused EIR, what is the timeline in doing that and the potential costs in doing that?
Well,
has that been communicated with the applicant?
No, not to date. The process would be that staff would work on an initial study. If at the end of that initial study we find that there is an issue that's potentially significant, then the applicant has the ability to just agree to prepare an environmental impact report. If they don't agree, then we come back in front of your board and the board reviews the initial study and makes the call whether an environmental impact report is appropriate and how it should be focused and scoped. That process, the preparation of an environmental impact report, can be a year or potentially more, and it can be quite costly. I don't even want to venture a range, but you know, even a focused environmental impact report can still be quite costly.
Okay. And you mentioned that LAFCO did approve the annexation of this property previously with a couple of conditions. One is that they put it in a permanent ag easement or conservation easement. What was the other one?
Or that a general plan amendment be completed.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Supervisor Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you just answered one of my questions on the annexation issues. Except, did we have a recent word from Mr. Church at LAFCO on this? Did we have him weigh in at all?
Yes, I actually, my comments were almost verbatim.
Okay.
His email to me.
So one other question, and I guess it has to do with the conflicts with some of the ag policies. The site is not currently being used for ag production, and according to the report, it's not. It's not really the potential for it to be farmed is not great. Is that correct?
Well, it's not currently being actively farmed. There are properties in the area that are being used for primarily grain and hay production. So this site has at least that potential.
Okay.
And yes, it is prime soils. Oh, and also I forgot to mention that the property is currently not within the sphere for the CSD.
Okay. So with it being prime soils then, and with there being nearby grain and hay production, the ability for it to be used as ag production is then high rather than what it suggests here, which is not, the potential is not great.
I don't know if it's necessarily high. I think there's just potential there.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Supervisor Meacham.
Thank you. I guess I'm trying. This is a difficult one because, is this property in the URL?
No, it is not.
And then who would make the determination?
Okay. Supervisor Gibson.
Let me add to the complication, if we might. And I would be, I know you have slips in front of you, and I'd be interested in hearing from the applicant. If that annexation was conditionally approved by LAFCO in 07 and expired, a new annexation request would have a couple of moving parts that are significant. One is to get it inside the sphere of influence, which it needs to be before the annexation is considered. And the second is, since 07, LAFCO has instituted a policy that's going to require at least one-to-one mitigation for any conversion of prime ag land, whether or not that is independent of the land use category that happens to apply to it. I guess my my thought here is, and I expect, I see a couple of slips, I see a couple of members of the public, we may be able to match that up. I'd like to hear a little bit more about the overall vision of the CSD as to what, you know, do you have a facilities plan that looks forward? Is this outlined someplace where we're looking to see that you need a new wastewater site, at what point and under what conditions? Do you need a new fire training facility as opposed to one that might service a range of the smaller fire departments in the North County or even in the county as a whole? You know, are you aware of the issues regarding ag land conversions and the necessity to mitigate these? You know, how are we doing with the access issues across the railroad tracks? And one question of staff is, you showed a controlled at-grade crossing. Is that the is that on the property? Does that give direct access to the property? My recollection is that the previous one, it was not that controlled site.
I wasn't the planner back in 2008, but it is. It does provide the primary access to the site.
Okay. So, you know, I'm wondering if there are yet some conversations that need to go on, getting LAFCO staff to the table along with planning staff, CSD staff, understanding the longer-term image. So I'd like to hear from the CSD at this point and figure out where we go from there.
Very good. Thank you, Supervisor Gibson. And that's where we are in this point of the hearing. We do have representatives from the we have the chief from the Templeton Fire Department, as well as the general manager of the Templeton Community Services District, here to answer questions, and I'll go ahead and call Mr. Hodge up, who is the general manager of the Templeton Community Services District, followed by Chief Langborg, who is the Templeton Fire Chief currently. So, Mr. Hodge.
Thank you. Always nice to be in front of you again. Here we are again talking about an issue to help out the North County and the Templeton area in particular. Just to start with answering some of the questions, I understand in 2007 at that time there was the park that was on the part of it. So with the public access across that at-grade railroad crossing, that was becoming expensive. I mean, we began looking into it, but it needed more. So what's changed in the interim is that we have realized through some of our initial master planning with our water and wastewater resources that, and since 2007, we've located two wells there, a deep well and a shallow alluvium well that that for our municipal purposes. So right now we do have a contract out there for both the master plan and their more focused plan on our overall utility needs. So in the interim, the chief will speak about his facility and his coming in and seeing that there's the possibility to put that facility there and help with the training of our firefighters, not only in Templeton, but in the surrounding areas for mutual response and aid. But during that time, that's prompted us now to be looking at these issues again, in that this does present itself as one of the very likely sites to entertain putting a future treatment facility. And some of the things that have changed since 2007 is the regulations on our side. As you know, in the North County, we've banded together to do the salt and nutrient management plan. A lot of the salts are coming out of the ground, of the groundwater we pump, and then because of the hardness, a lot of the water softeners add to that. The regulations are coming at us from the wastewater side, but that is not the place, in our opinion, to take care of it. It's to take care of it at the as it comes out of the ground and deliver people with or deliver to the homes a cleaner water supply that's not as hard to help alleviate those accumulation of salts in the in alluvium and our wastewater treatment plant. But at this point, we're still looking at that. So, I mean, that's what we want to know, is that if we cannot move forward with some of the sites that could be potential sites for them. So very preliminary.
So if, let's say, for example, that this site was determined to be the site for your wastewater facility or a public facility of some sort, and you're still allowed to do that on ag zoned land, then I guess the main issue would be the tax issue.
Correct.
Okay.
Well, and to follow up on that, Ms. Griffin, as I understand it, we talked about that, and changing the zoning to a public facility would not change the taxing status. It's only if it's annexed into the CSD would the taxing status change.
That's correct.
Is that right? So
yes.
It would actually, in order to receive that benefit, it would have to go through LAFCO and be annexed into the CSD, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
But by the same token, I mean, they can't go to LAFCO unless they can get the general plan amendment authorization. Because I'm kind of getting this, that LAFCO is saying you guys need to do this, and we're saying, well, you need to do that. So which one do they need to do?
Or put it in a conservation easement.
Well, maybe if I can weigh in, having been on LAFCO for a while. I don't think there's any question that if it's decided in an overall land use discussion that this is a site that needs public facilities for the community of Templeton, LAFCO will be, working to see about the annexation. I mean, that's a natural part. We allow public agencies to annex even discontiguous piece of property outside of city limits, if you will, if that's a water well as part of their deal. I think, though, that the question of changing the land use category really is not, just to be honest, relevant at this time. It's really more a matter of understanding what a logical extension of uses within the community of Templeton is, and it sounds like you're just starting that in your master planning effort. And where I was going is in terms of the needs you have, both in water treatment pre-delivery, in wastewater treatment post-delivery. Have you looked at the range of alternatives for those places to be sited, the nature of the technologies, all the things that you need to do from an engineering standpoint to get ready to serve your community? Where are you in that alternatives analysis?
We've done that for the wastewater side of things at this point, and we're proceeding forward with that. We're looking to return our sewer flows from 2/3 of them right now go to Paso Robles. We're looking to return them to our existing facility. Mm-hmm. And once again, a huge component of that is the reuse and reclaim of that water to alleviate the pumping of groundwater long-term-wise. And what has also happened prior to my tenure there is we have located two of our water wells there. So it is already under that part of the utility side. We threw in the others because we have the fire side of things, and just we weren't 100% sure with the wastewater side of things, so we threw that in there as a potential use.
And those are the pieces that I think may argue for a little greater discussion. You know, and I'll just use your words. You threw in the fire training facility. You may need the wastewater. And again, our planning staff is very highly constrained on resources to take care of these things. And I'm just wondering, and I would be interested to hear from the chief on the fire training issues, whether we need a little clearer picture of what TCSD needs in the medium, short, medium, and long term before we start making a lot of detailed land use decisions that might involve a lot of staff time. It's just a thought. We'll see where we go with that discussion.
Okay. I have no further questions at this point for Mr. Hodge. Did you want to make any other comments, Mr. Hodge? Or?
No, that's the big one, is that we just want to move forward so that it can help with our long-term planning, realizing if we're going to be taxed on future improvements that we place on that site that we can go wide open, eyes wide open with it.
Very, very good. Thank you, Mr. Hodge. And now if Chief Jim Langbert would like to speak to the fire training facility that they have plans for, and I understand there's a application already submitted for that facility.
There is, and first, thank you for having me. I haven't had a chance to introduce myself to all of you. I'm kind of the new guy. I've been here almost 2 years now, but I'm Jim, if you've heard about me. I'd like to fill you in on a little bit of information about our fire training facility, basically what it is and why we need it, and maybe I can address some of the things or the comments that I've heard to this point. The first thing that I'll share with you in terms of the planning, when I was first hired, we started a strategic planning process a little over a year ago. And that strategic planning process consisted of input from internal and external stakeholders. What is of interest is that our number one priority in that strategic planning process was training. And in particular, the hands-on portion of the training was the biggest issue, because it's considered a safety issue both for our firefighters and the citizens that we protect. So just to kind of emphasize, and that we can take care of business and protect not only the people but the property, which in my opinion is a big issue at this point, particularly with businesses in this economy today. We want to do a good job. What we're looking at is we're looking at taking four donated C-Train containers, attaching them together, putting them on top of a couple of concrete piers, cutting some holes in the bottom to make sure, because we are in a floodplain, that water can go through there effectively and they won't float off. But more importantly, we're trying to come up with a very cheap and, again, cost-effective way that I can train my firefighters. There is no facility like this in the North County at all. Because I feel it's so important, we've opened this resource up to other fire departments. Anybody is welcome to use it. The location is ideal. It's about from the location to the freeway, it's up 3 minutes. And that allows access for both the city of Paso Robles and the city of Atascadero and Station 30 with Cal Fire. On top of that, this also opens the avenue to have multi-jurisdictional drills, which is extremely important because there is not a fire department in the North County that can support a first alarm fire by themselves. So we are working together. This helps iron out those issues ahead of time. The last thing, and I don't have this information, but I think it's kind of just food for thought. When we're talking about that railway crossing, first of all, I'm looking at my department using this on an average of about once a week, so it's not going to be a high-use item. The second thing is that I've worked in jurisdictions with railways that were busy. This does not seem to be a busy railway to me, and I'd be happy to look into the fact how many trains cross that area a day in terms of, you know, how much delay that would cause and how much danger that exists with that railway and crossing that. And with that, I'll be quiet, and I'll be happy to address any questions that you have.
Okay. I see no questions. A very thorough presentation. Thank you, Chief.
I would just ask, it seems like the establishment of this fire training facility is very low impact on the ground.
That is correct.
Are you going to take water supply from your municipal water system that's connected to the wells on the
right property? And there's not going to be any burning in there. You're going to squirt a little bit of water here and there. This is just more hands-on drag and charge hose lines through a simulated room.
But you're talking concrete pier. I mean, you've got a whole conditional use permit application in that's addressing exactly what that proposed
correct.
Project.
We have submitted
okay.
that. And I guess one last thing, and then I promise I will be quiet. I do urge your support to help us turn this into public facilities, because then we, at least from my perspective, when I'm talking about the size of my budget, we can, if we are annexed in there, it can save me a couple of thousand a year out of my budget that I can use better than paying taxes.
Yes, thank you, Chief Langberg. It appears to me, and Ms. Griffin, that concludes questions from the board at this point in time, so I'll close it to public comment. I have no more requests to speak, but you two gentlemen stand by in case we do have other questions. But it seems to me that there's really two separate issues here. If we separate out the fire training facility, they have an application in for that, and I assume that could move forward while or not.
Well,
tell us the
problem is that CEQA makes us look at the whole of the project, and unless County Council tells me I'm incorrect, I don't think we're able to separate out the conditional use permit review from the general plan amendment review. I was correct. I like it when the lawyers tell me I'm right.
Okay, so I do think it's important to articulate the timing difference. That was one of the things that we had discussed. A conditional use permit takes, you know, 4 to 6 months, and that
yeah.
can happen if we roll it into a conditional use permit GPA, and it requires a CEQA analysis or an EIR. Then we're talking a year or more and
correct.
And more money.
Correct.
So, okay. All right, Supervisor Gibson, and then Supervisor Meacham.
I'd certainly defer to the supervisor of the district if you'd like to start this, but I have a question back to council.
Okay. Supervisor Meacham.
I guess so. I guess I'm not. I don't see any harm in allowing them to proceed with this because there's going to be a lot of questions that are going to have to be answered as this goes forward. And if we, if they can't, if LAFCO is not going to do whatever they need to do without us approving them moving forward with the general plan amendment, then it seems to me that they're kind of stuck. So I don't see the harm in allowing this to proceed for the application.
Correct. If you said today, no, we're not going to authorize this general plan amendment, then that's a project that doesn't exist anymore, and we'll just simply process the conditional use permit, which is this particular use is allowed in the agriculture land use category, and we would just process it just like we do everything else. The only difference is we'll be coming to you for a request for fee waiver.
And then, but going back from a timing standpoint, if we were to say no to the processing right now, and they go ahead and get the approval for their conditional use permit, that doesn't preclude them from coming back after that's approved and then request the general plan amendment for a change at that point.
Sure. After, for instance, when they finish up their alternatives analysis, looking for wastewater sites and doing the rest of the review that they're doing as a district, if, you know, a year from now they came back, they can do that. They can re-request even when you say no. There is a time period that has to pass, which I'd have to look up in the ordinance to know how much time that is. But once that time period is passed, they can ask again for a general plan amendment.
Hey, for colleagues, I mean, I don't want to hold up the fire training facility. I think that that's important for that community, and I think it's something that they've been working hard to get towards. But I think hearing from Mr. Hodge that they are now undergoing an assessment of really what they want to do, that allows for time for them to do that. And let the fire facility continue to move on, and then once that assessment's been done, to come back and then look at the general plan amendment application at that point.
Well, and my understanding also of the fire training facility is that it isn't necessarily a permanent structure. So it may be that after they do their assessment, they not only find a better location for their wastewater, but they also find that they can move this facility and, you know, who knows what the future will bring. And so then it is a series of unknowns, which in that case we're not obligated under CEQA to try and review something we don't know about.
Okay.
Supervisor Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Mr. Meacham is on to something here, and it was really my same concern. I want to get TCSD going with the least cost to them to get the job done that they need to do. And land use is a complex and some say irrational business, but let's call it just complex at this point. The general plan amendment, so far as I know, is not required for you to pursue annexation through LAFCO. And I would encourage you to contact LAFCO and have that conversation directly with them. And I wanted to confirm with council is if they pull the general plan amendment back, let's say they cancel any pursuit of a general plan amendment, a conditional use permit simply for a fire training facility constitutes the whole of the action under consideration by this county. Is that correct?
I'm Tim McNulty with the County Council's office. I think Ms. Griffin had it pretty much correct that we would be required to analyze the whole of whatever is currently being proposed, and if the board denies the ability to go forward with the land use or general plan amendment, then the only thing that we'd be facing would be the conditional use permit.
So I would submit to TCSD that our refusing to process this GPA actually saves you time and money, odd as it may seem. The door is open to come back for further consideration as your plans evolve, and your fire training facility, I think, goes on a easier, cheaper, faster track by us not processing this GPA.
And I totally concur with that. The objective, and as Chief Langbord pointed out, this facility is going to be available to all the fire jurisdictions in the North County, and I'm sure it would get put to use immediately, and they could probably have it up and running as soon as they get a permit. But if you process it together with a GPA, it's a year or more, mm-hmm. and a lot more money. Yeah. And so I would be inclined, assuming, again, what Supervisor Meacham is suggesting, that I would be supportive of that. And again, they can come back at some point in the future and ask for that GPA. In the meantime, they can be using the fire facility. Supervisor Hill.
Yeah, I just not be brief. I was really unclear with everything until the discussion now. So to me, it does seem much clearer in the sense that pursuing the conditional use permit for the for the training facility is really the most important immediate objective, and rather than complicating that and slowing it down by putting it as part of the larger amendment, I think we should, and then Mr. Hodge and planning and Mr. Church could get together and talk about the larger picture too. But it seems like the most immediate need, and I think the chief always a sucker for an articulate fire chief. I think he did a good job talking about the project and its certain usefulness in the North County. So I think we all want to see that move forward. So I'll
right. Voice vote is adequate, so all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion carries. And conditional use permit, that just works right through the county, right over the counter.
Right. You'll actually see in a couple of weeks the request for the fee waiver.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's just do that now.
All right. So with that, we will head off into closed session. I'll open it to the public on items on closed session, but I have no request to speak. So I'll close it to the public and ask Mr. Jensen for an estimated time in closed session.
About 45 minutes.
Okay, very good. And we will reconvene at 1:30.
Your microphones are live.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the afternoon session of the April 24th meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors. And we have a report out of closed session. Mr. Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Warren Jensen, the County Council. The board did meet in closed session. No reportable action was taken.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Jensen. First thing on the agenda this afternoon the reading of a couple of resolutions.
Move to approve.
Move to approve. Second. Good work. Is there a second? Moved and seconded that we adopt our presentation calendar. Roll call, Madam Clerk.
Mr. Meacham.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill.
Yes.
Mr. Gibson.
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira.
Yes.
Mr. Patterson.
Yes. And with that, we'll start with Supervisor Adam Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see our sheriff and our new undersheriff and I believe some of our fine correctional deputies and officers. So would you like to come forward, sheriff and undersheriff, and I don't know if some of our correctional officers would also? You guys tell me who you want to bring up. We'll let the sheriff and the undersheriff. They're not moving until their bosses say it's okay.
Right.
I've noticed, so. This is a resolution proclaiming May 1st through 7th National Correctional Officers Week. Whereas the first week of May is recognized as National Correctional Officers and Employees Week, whereas within the San Luis Obispo Sheriff's Office, correctional deputies provide important services to citizens by maintaining the safety and security of the county jail, and whereas the staff at the county jail is comprised of approximately 165 correctional deputies, correctional technicians, legal clerks, food service personnel, medical and mental health professionals, and whereas with a steady increase in the number of incarcerated inmates who have substance abuse and medical and mental health problems, correctional deputies and custody staff work under demanding and often dangerous circumstances. The contributions made by these professionals, while not highly visible, are significant and play a vital role in our criminal justice system. San Luis Obispo County will recognize the valuable contributions of the Sheriff's Office custody staff for the important role they play in preserving public safety and maintaining a highly professional county jail. Now, therefore, be it resolved and ordered at the Board that the Board of Supervisors does hereby recognize and appreciate the ongoing public service the correctional deputies and custody staff provide to the residents of San Luis Obispo County. And
I think we should be shaking hands with the correctional.
We could wait if you want to say a few things, Sheriff, and then you can.
How about if I say a few things and it'll give them a little bit of time to get up here?
Okay.
They deal with the inmates of the jail all day long,
yes.
And they're hesitant to approach this dais. I just don't get it.
Well, first of all, good afternoon, Ian Parkinson, Sheriff, and the new Undersheriff, Tim Olivas. And Tim is actually responsible for the jail, and I'll spare him since it's week two from getting into any deep discussion on the jail. But just to point out a couple things. First, thank you for the resolution and recognizing the hard work that they do. The job is a difficult one. They're responsible for the care and safety of all inmates in custody, which is a task. If you're a father or a mother, you understand that task. The truth is the job has changed dramatically over the last 6 months, because in addition to their care and safety of the inmate, they have to really worry about more about their care and, or the safety of their employees and themselves as well. With AB 109 coming into play, the jail has changed dramatically. It's becoming more of a small prison because of the class of inmate that's coming in. And it's also changing in the sense that it has been discussed many times at this board, the challenges of trying to reduce recidivism through programming. And it's an exciting time in the sense that hopefully we're going to do a better job than the state did with reducing that rate, and not to knock the state. But the reality is these are people that...
We very much appreciate the work and appreciate the... circumstances under which you work on a daily basis 24/7. So our hats off to you, and thank you for doing this very essential service for the residents of San Luis Obispo County. So thank you. Well, okay, our next item, I have the pleasure of reading, and I believe our District Attorney Jerry Shea is going to be the recipient, and Cindy as well. And let me read this resolution proclaiming the week of April 22nd to April 28th, 2012, as San Luis Obispo County Crime Victims' Rights Week. Whereas thousands of San Luis Obispo County residents and visitors are directly harmed by crime each year, and each crime affects additional family members, friends, neighbors, and coworkers. And whereas for the past 35 years, San Luis Obispo County crime victims have benefited from local government and community-based victim service agencies working to protect and promote the rights of crime victims while providing a host of crisis and support services to help them rebuild their lives after crime. And whereas the District Attorney's Victim Witness Assistance Center works in partnership with the Women's Shelter Program of San Luis Obispo, the North County Women's Shelter and Resource Center, the Sexual Assault Recovery and Prevention Center, and the County Social Services and Probation Departments to extend the vision of victims' rights and services through a comprehensive approach to reaching victims of crime, including those who are underserved. Whereas four individuals, Julia Scott Starkey, Donna Jones, and Tracy Nix, and one business, Edna Valley Vineyard, are being recognized today for making significant contributions to crime victims' rights and services in San Luis Obispo County, and will be honored at a special awards ceremony on April 26th. Now, therefore, be it resolved and ordered by the Board of Supervisors as follows. The county proclaims the week of April 22nd to April 28th as San Luis Obispo County Crime Victims' Rights Week, and in doing so reaffirms our commitment to respect and enforce victims' rights and address their needs this week and throughout the year. So thank you. We have four resolutions in there, Joy. And if you two would like to elaborate a little bit on what we're doing, very good. Oh, they do with everybody?
Thank you very much, and good afternoon, Jerry Shea, District Attorney. Mr. Chair and members of the board, thank you very much for this proclamation declaring this week to be Victims' Rights Week in San Luis Obispo County, April 22nd through the 28th. And I can guarantee you that this proclamation will be displayed prominently at the award ceremony this Thursday, which we'll talk a little bit more about in a few minutes. But thank you very much for the proclamation. It means a lot to our staff and to the staffs of all the different departments that you mentioned. And I should say that kind of coincidentally, this week coincides with the National Crime Victims' Rights Week, which celebrates its 28th anniversary of the signing back in 1984 of the National Victims of Crime Act. It's called VOCA. It's important because VOCA has supported and funded both the counties and the states' victim compensation programs over the years. So it's a very important year nationally as well as locally. But I should say that not to be outdone by the national folks and the national efforts, our county took the lead in providing victims' rights services long ago by creating such programs as the Victim Witness Division back 35 years ago. They're celebrating their 35th anniversary. The Women's Shelter Program of San Luis Obispo, believe it or not, is celebrating its 33rd anniversary. The North County Women's Shelter and Resource Program is celebrating its 30th birthday. And the SARP Center, the Sexual Assault Recovery and Prevention Center, is over 36 years old. So those programs have really been in the forefront, not only in the county and the state, but nationally, if you think about it, in terms of how long and how much foresight and vision that they've had over the years. So thank you for your support of those organizations. And I should say those four organizations have worked really collaboratively, kind of in a unique way over the years, in a very close network in trying to provide victim services, whether they be victims' direct services or prevention services. And those four organizations, along with two of your county departments, the Probation Department and the Department of Social Services, are collaborating again this week in putting on an award ceremony this Thursday, which, of course, each of you is invited to attend, and about which Cindy Marie Apsey, who is our Executive Director for the Victim Witness Division, would like to say a few words, if she may. So, okay. Cindy Marie, come on up. All right.
Good afternoon. Cindy Marie Apsey, Victim Witness Director for the District Attorney's Office. And thank you so much for the Rep. Jones is here with us today. And Donna is the recipient of the Champion Award for her 17 years plus investigating domestic violence crimes and crimes involving intimate partner violence. And those are a very challenging type of crime. Donna has really acquired an outstanding reputation for her expertise in that area and her sensitivity to victims. And then also today we have with us Tracy Nix, our child interview specialist for the DA's office. And Tracy has 13 years with us, and she also makes it a very important contribution to not only solving crimes, but paving the way so that child victims can get treatment, they and their families. And they would like to take just a few brief minutes to thank you today for your recognition. Tracy and Donna.
Thank you so very much. I'm Tracy Nix. Thank you for allowing us this opportunity and giving us this recognition. And for myself, I don't do this in a vacuum, so it's completely a humbling experience for me to be standing up here today. I was thinking about what I wanted to say, and what I'd like to say is that I truly do believe our children are our most valuable and vulnerable gifts. And so when they come in and they talk to me, they truly are my heroes. And I learn more from them and their resiliency and their capacity to forgive and move on those people who hurt them in the most unspeakable ways, that they are heroic to me and they are my champions. And that is why I do what I do, so that hopefully one day in the future they can look back on that 1 hour they spent in my office where they weren't hurt and they were heard and they were believed, and hopefully that will carry them through in life. Thank you.
Hi, Donna Jones from the DA's office. Just briefly want to thank you for the honor. And I accept the honor. I can't do this job without all the other peace officers in this county. And really, our service and our response to victims of crime starts with the line officer, the person who takes the 911 call, the first responder, the one that gets there in the heat of the moment. And it starts there and usually ends with me at some point. But I accept this honor on their behalf as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you again for your support. I really appreciate it. Would you mind a photo with the two
You bring them all.
Not
up.
At all.
You bring everybody.
Yeah.
Bring up everybody.
Including
yeah.
the victim witness staff. Great. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Even and you.
Even let the DA get in the phone.
Oh, okay.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're going to make me dress up again.
No, thank you. Wesley said, too.
Thank you for being here.
We're going to shift over. You're going to have to trust the sheriff's aim.
Go.
We're not talking about the camera.
Uh-oh. We might need some people in another row in front, maybe.
Another row in front, just on that side.
There we go.
There we go.
How about some more? Don't be afraid of Jerry.
He doesn't have a
shift. Shift just a little bit.
Two steps to the left, ladies and gentlemen. Good deal.
Thanks for all your work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank
you. I'll see you on Thursday. Save me a seat.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
I love the fact that you're at least 7 years ahead of the national effort to provide these services. So, you're in good company, all of you. Thank you, and all of your partners as well in this. We act very closely with all of those organizations as members of our board, and we appreciate the work they do, and thank you for organizing this today. All right. Madam Clerk, would you introduce the next item, please?
Certainly. That's item 17, consideration of, one, a letter transmitting plans and specifications for the Los Osos Wastewater Project Collection System Areas BNC, Los Osos, California, contract 30044.
So he's not here today. And I'll have a relatively brief PowerPoint presentation to cover the recommended items today. I also wanted to introduce to my right here Robert Ruiz. And Robert came on board in October. He's John's primary assistant on the collection system. We also have a number of individuals in the audience who, depending on the level of Q&A and the technical issues, there's a lot of technical items that will also help with questions and answers today. And with that, I will move forward. Overall, the four sets of recommendations. One is to go out and advertise on collection systems areas B and C as a combined contract. Recent questions have come up on our plans and specifications regarding air quality requirements, and I'll touch on those in a minute. The second set is award a contract for the construction of the Midtown restoration. That's the first contract that your board let out for advertising. And that specifically is required in order to comply with the condition established by the Coastal Commission. Restoration of Midtown is necessary in order to cure a violation of the CSD's coastal development permit on the prior project. Adopting a resolution related to USDA funding is to be able to accept the just over $4 million in grants offered by USDA, as well as to prepare us for the final closing documents on the permanent USDA funding, which is anticipated in the end of May. And then last is the recycled water agreement with San Luis Coastal Unified School District. I'll touch on a number of items related to that, and also note that some of the representatives of Golden State Water as well as LOCSD are in attendance, and we'll probably want to provide some comments to your board as well on that. With respect to the collection system contracting schedule, again, in the middle, this is areas B and C, so the planned bid period is between today and May 31st with an anticipated award back to your board on June 19th. Overall, the collection system has been divvied up into three different contracts, areas A and D, which the board already let out for bid, and we would anticipate being back on June 5th to award that. As a note, we've got 15 contractors who have obtained bid packages on areas A and D, so we're hoping that's a good response to getting a lot of bidders involved. And then the third is the pump stations, which we'll be bidding out later, and in essence that, you know, the two different collection systems or two different zones of the collection systems, and then third is the pump stations will come in after that. With respect to the air quality, we have gotten some comments from contractors regarding the air quality requirements within the plans and specifications. Mr. Hutchinson can address details in terms of the thresholds that were evaluated in the EIR and why we have some pretty significant air quality requirements. From a very general perspective, I think it's easy to recognize that this is a significant project with a lot of heavy equipment that's going to be in the middle of neighborhoods, and therefore we do have some stringent air quality requirements. But we will be putting out an addendum to the contractors in order to clarify an important issue, which is that the trucking traffic that goes in and out of town, if they're bringing in materials or if they're exporting, that those trucks are not subject to the more critical air quality requirements. It's the heavy equipment that's operating in the normal conduct of the project within the community itself. And again, heavy equipment in close proximity to all the homes is why the thresholds have been exceeded and why we have additional requirements for that activity, again, within a town. I think in the board package, you'll note that, especially in the budget, that the engineer's estimates are certainly significantly lower than what our original project estimates are. And so we have good engineer's estimates. We, of course, are going to have to wait for bids to actually be obtained to see where they're coming in. So at this point in time, we're sort of maintaining the position of being cautiously optimistic. And then lastly, between awarding and between giving the actual notice to proceed, we still do have pre-construction conditions that we need to comply with. Most significantly are the conditions established by the Coastal Commission. I'm just going to summarize those. Really, the Habitat Management Plan, not to be confused with the Habitat Conservation Plan, but the Habitat Management Plan as part of our Coastal Development Permit. We originally provided that to Coastal in May of 2011, and we've recently gotten some minor comments, so we expect to have those revisions and approval by Coastal in the very near future. The Regional Water Management Plan we submitted in November of 2011, and we should be getting comments any day now. We understand Coastal staff is meeting today to provide us final comments. Again, the early discussions we've had with them is that we're not anticipating any significant recommended edits to that. There's a whole category of design requirements, and we've had some. We're responding to questions from Coastal staff with respect to that, and we have not heard of any, grave concerns with regard to that particular issue. Originally, Coastal was indicating that they might be at their May Coastal hearing, and now it appears that it's more likely to be at the June hearing. So, all of this really is coming together in under our critical timing. It's not uncommon for the compliance of pre-construction conditions to be timed when we're going out for bid. Even in some cases, sometimes it does delay the notice to proceed for the contractor. Most notably on the Nacimiento project, our work on Camp Roberts, we had to make sure to address some of the camp's concerns and work out some of the environmental mitigation issues along the camp before we were able to give the NTP for that portion of the collection system on the Nacimiento project. With respect to the Midtown Restoration Award, again, as a restoration of the Midtown site, that was the significant coastal development permit violation of the prior project that we are going to be carrying as a result of this contract award. To Arbourg Corporation, no protests on the bids. The bid itself is below the engineer's estimate in total construction amount of just over $400,000, estimating about 2 months for construction, and we certainly want to be able to jump on this one and move forward as soon as we can. We are also in discussions with Coastal about getting the early authorization to proceed to construction on this particular project because it's really not part of our collection system, our wastewater project construction activities, it's really curing the violation of the prior project. So that discussions with coastal staff is ongoing, and we would like to be able to proceed with that expeditiously. Normally, after your board's award of a construction contract, it's a 3 to 5 or 4 to 6 week period before an NTP is actually awarded. The contractors have to provide insurance, they have to provide construction. We have to have the execution of the contract, and we also have to have our pre-conference meeting. So certainly in the next 4 to 6 weeks, we hope to get all of the clearances so that we can proceed in a normal fashion. And even the revocation hearing that's anticipated with Coastal works within that time frame. On the USDA loan resolution itself, I think as you can note, this is a loan resolution that is USDA's format, and it's the final board approval that's necessary so that we can, in essence, execute the escrow documents in order to close the USDA funding, which again is anticipated for about May 22nd. It also accepts the $4 million in grants, and the grant agreement is as well attached. And so with this loan resolution, it authorizes the chairperson of your board, as well as myself, to execute those final closing documents and awarding the restoration contract for Midtown, as well as the final item, which is the recycled water agreement, are some of those that are necessary in order to do the final closing with USDA on the permanent financing. The recycled water agreement itself helps to satisfy a pre-construction condition from USDA, which is in essence to make sure that we can adequately dispose of the recycled water. It provides water to all four of Los Osos schools, and the San Luis Coastal Unified School District currently uses recycled school water here in the community of San Luis Obispo. It was unanimously approved by the school district board. And it's an important component of our project because of the conditions established in the coastal development permit, which compels us to pursue those efforts that mitigate seawater intrusion to the greatest degree possible. And so certainly converting the school districts off of the potable water system and into a reclaimed or recycled water system will help reduce pumping. And it will also help then to mitigate seawater intrusion. The agreement was structured in a manner envisioning that there would be transferability provisions over to the water purveyors. This was a discussion that we had at the school board hearing. As an example, one of the questions that came up from the school board was in terms of the water quality commitments that we're making to meet Title 22 tertiary unrestricted recycled and reuse provisions, that in envisioning that this agreement is transferable to the water purveyors, so one of the school board members asked me, could they anticipate then that the purveyors would be responsible for water quality? And to what I responded that, no, you can anticipate that the county would continue to be responsible for water quality because we're the ones who are operating the wastewater treatment, the recycled water treatment facilities. And so the provision does provide for the transferability construction contract for the Midtown site restoration. On the paragraph prior to all of the bids, it says storm drainage improvements along Los Osos Valley Road fronting the Midtown site are also a part of this work. Is that because of the grading that took place on the Midtown site, or is that part of the anticipated work necessary for the project? I might ask for Jeff for a little bit of help on that. I would say that, in general, the drainage, we have culverts that go under Los Osos Valley Road right now, and we have done culvert repairs on them. We had a project within the last 12 to 24 months for culvert replacements, and so then the outlet to those culverts then, discharge water onto the Midtown site. And so certainly some of that discharge and erosion was exacerbated as a result of the prior grading that occurred on Midtown when they basically dug the big hole. That speeds up the flow of water, causes back cutting, it causes erosion. On the other hand, from a roads perspective within the right-of-way, we also want to armor up the outlet to the culvert to make sure that it doesn't damage the county road system. So to me, it's the need is a combination of both the wastewater project as well as our normal road work in the vicinity.
And that's where I was going with this, because I don't know how can we charge all of the folks in the prohibition zone money for something that we were going to have to fix partly anyway if it's part of our operating procedures.
Jeff Worst, Design Division Manager for the Public Works Department. The improvements associated with this project, as Mr. Ogren had indicated, are to address the higher velocity scour that's coming from an existing drainage inlet. And as Paavo had indicated, there was an existing erosion at the site. And so we have proposed in this project to have rock slope protection to mitigate further scour and erosion at the site. So it's a small portion of the project that's actually in the county right-of-way that mitigates the erosion coming off of Los Osos Valley Road onto this site. It's a natural drainage course, so these improvements are to mitigate, you know, higher velocity flows that would be coming from the site. So.
Okay, thanks. And Pablo, on all of the bids that were received, do they all meet the APCD or the Air Resources Board's requirements for the equipment?
So as part of the contractor's equipment submittals, then, we're going to have to look at that equipment, and we're going to have to confer with APCD to confirm compliance or to determine how we will otherwise comply.
And is that a compliance required by APCD or the State Air Resources Board? Or
I'm going to let Mark answer that. My understanding is that it was a air quality compliance standard that was a project condition as a result of the air quality analysis done on the project, but through the coastal development permit as opposed to a separate APCD. But I'll let Mark.
I'll try. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, Mark Hutchinson, Department of Public Works Environmental Division Manager. I'll try to keep this brief. The two conditions that have raised some questions read like this, and they're in the air quality section, and there are many, but these two, one of them says all diesel construction equipment shall meet ARB's, that's California Air Resource Board's, Tier 3 standard for off-road heavy-duty diesel engines. The second says all on-road heavy-duty trucks that meet the ARB's 2007 or newer certification standard for on-road heavy-duty diesel engines. We actually corrected the typo in that one in our conditions. So on-road stuff, 2007 standard, off-road stuff, Tier 3 standard. Air Pollution Control District made those comments in 2009 in response to the initial consultations on the environmental impact report. The reason that they adopted those two standards, among others, is because of the special conditions of the project. They cite in their letter that we have a long construction period, up to 2 years. We have a great deal of heavy equipment, diesel-powered, and we're in very close proximity to what is termed sensitive receptors. And for the California toxics rule and diesel exhaust, that includes residences, schools, and care homes, all of which may contain vulnerable populations. We calculated that our air emissions in the critical areas are between 10 and 20 times the applicable thresholds. So we're well and above what a safe level of diesel exhaust would be considered for these particular conditions, remembering that Los Osos is generally a very dense community. APCD's CEQA handbook, their guidelines, require that we apply what's called best available control technology. And in CEQA, we're required to apply mitigation where polluted areas of the state. So the equipment does exist. As Pablo mentioned, however, the appropriate staff are going to be producing an addendum to the standards to explain exactly where these apply on this project and where they don't. Essentially, and I'm just paraphrasing it, these standards would apply to any on- or off-road diesel engines that are operated by the contractors and subcontractors regularly used on the project, regularly used. So if someone's delivering materials from outside the area in a truck, it comes in, it shuts off, unloads, leaves. That doesn't go to the health issue that we're trying to address, which is the ongoing operation of diesel equipment close to houses. So that clarification will go out in the next day or two. These conditions do apply to the Midtown project. They're in an attachment to an attachment somewhere. They're a bit more obvious in this one. The reason they were stated that way in the Midtown is because that project is projected to last 20 to 21 working days with diesel equipment off-road. And so far as we can tell at this point, there is no on-road equipment that would meet that operating on a regular basis on the project in close proximity to residences. So it's a bit of a below-the-thresholds calculation.
Going back to your, you mentioned a little earlier, where feasible, what does that feasibility mean? Is it economically feasible? Is it?
I think in the CEQA world, it doesn't specifically define feasible. They let you argue that out in court if you mess it up. But we know that APCD goes pretty good detail about best available control technology, and their air quality handbook's quite extensive and detailed. And we would have to agree with them that under that standard and under these particular conditions, it would be warranted. And it would be feasible to require that kind of equipment for those parts of the project.
Okay. I have one other question, but this will be somebody else. In regard to the page 5 of 7 down towards the bottom, talking about the agricultural reuse, irrigation crops with recycled water, it says basically that the initial interest hasn't been there from the ag folks. What happens if we don't get that interest? What happens if we can't?
So the interest that we have in the participation agreements that your board has already approved are sufficient for our condition compliance. What we're just saying in here is that we would anticipate over time there's going to be a greater level of interest, even and above and beyond that minimum that we've already established.
Okay, that's it for now.
Okay, thank you. I see no more questions at this point in time from my colleagues on the board. Mr. Ohelski, he did come back in, so I'm going to open it to public comment. There are four areas of the project within this item, and so I'm going to extend the public comment period from 3 minutes to 4 minutes if you would like to speak on more than one item, and I'm going to begin with Marshall Ohilski, followed by Ken Peterson.
Marshall Ohilski, President of Los Osos CSD. I'm here to speak on the recycled water agreement, which is the primary issue that the CSD has concerns about at this point. I think staff has attempted in the staff report to address some of our concerns, but I'd just like to give a brief history and just, I guess, express some of the frustrations of my board on this particular item. In the beginning, when this project was first proposed, my board was adamant about the fact that all of the water from this project needed to be returned back to the groundwater basin. The original proposal was to return it to Los Osos Valley, not to the basin. Finally, at the last Planning Commission hearing, they actually did agree to return all the water, required that all the water be returned back to the basin. So we did get what we wanted in that particular regard. And we understood at that time that part of what would have to happen is that the water would have to be used at the school sites to irrigate the playing fields and recreational fields in order to return that water to the basin. That was all understood. The problem that we had with this particular issue at this time was that we were not involved in this process at all. And I take exception to the word in the staff report that calls that it was impractical to involve the water purveyors. Clearly, there did not need to be a three-way negotiation between the county, the school district, and the water purveyors. But I think some of the concerns that the water purveyors have at this point, time between now and when the recycled water is being used by the school district, is the one issue, which is the water quality issue that is addressed in the staff report, that the county will be responsible, or whoever the operator of the wastewater project is, will be responsible for assurances of the water quality. And secondly, and this should be self-evident, but it's the impact on our revenues. Being our largest water consumer, our concern was that the agreement with the school district does call for a 90% rate or a 10% reduction of the current rates, however you want to look at it. But we want to get assurances that that 90% is returned to the water purveyors and not, you know, become the purview of the county, and we're hit for a 90%. Unfortunately, again, the timing of this was very, very unfortunate for my district because we did just final our rate study. And for the record, I just want to make sure that this board and subsequent boards are aware of the fact that as we go forward and negotiate a memorandum of understanding with the county on this particular thing, that those two issues stay at the forefront, the water quality issue and the return of that revenue to the water purveyors. Again, I just think that this could have been handled better, and that's my district's position, and I appreciate the extra time, even though I spoke only one topic.
Thank you, Mr. Ohelski. Those issues are so noted. Ken Peterson, followed by Mike Brown.
Good afternoon, Chairman and members of the board. My name is Ken Peterson. I am the Coastal District Manager for the Golden State Water Company. And like Marshall, we like to read some comments into the record concerning the recycled water agreement that's under your consideration this afternoon. Golden State provides service to almost half the Los Osos community, and through the payment of water rates, our customers have made substantial investments in water infrastructure. For the past several years, we have been working cooperatively with our water purveyors and the county to develop a comprehensive plan for management of Los Osos Basin and halt seawater intrusion. The Los Osos wastewater project will be a significant impact on the basin, and we'll need to be an integral part of the management activities set forth in any future basin plan, including the use of recycled water. Golden State objects to the contract that was negotiated between the county and the school district on several legal and practical grounds. First, the agreement violates California Service Duplication Law. That law requires a utility to provide compensation to other utilities when it constructs and operates facilities that duplicate those already being operated by the existing utility. This law protects investments in water infrastructure that have been made by an existing utility and its customers. Here, the county's provision of recycled water to the schools for irrigation would duplicate Golden State's current delivery of water to those same purposes. As a result, the county will owe compensation to Golden State and the Los Osos CSD. Second, the county's delivery of water to the schools in Los Osos reduces overall number of water utility customers, and it diverts revenues once received by Golden State and Los Osos Community Service District to the county. The reduced customer base and the revenues will result in greater burdens on existing Los Osos customers by way of increased rates. While the county may think that it is saving its wastewater customers money by generating a new revenue source, in fact, it is only shifting costs from one pocket in Los Osos to another, harming the water purveyors in this process. The only party who benefits in the county itself is the county itself, not the ratepayers of Los Osos. Third, lastly, the agreement states the county public works director will support the school district's application to drill wells in the upper aquifer. The school district's pumping of groundwater would interfere with the existing senior water rights of the purveyors and agricultural users in the basin. If the school district were to drill wells and begin pumping, the action would harm the delicate balance of the basin and interfere with the plan to stop seawater intrusion. The county has harming efforts to balance the basin, water supplies and demands, and stops seawater intrusion in order to further its own narrow proprietary interests. We ask the county not to approve the agreement as written. Instead, work with the purveyors and develop acceptable terms and conditions for use of recycled water by the school district. Thank you.
A question, Mr. Peterson from Supervisor Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peterson.
Service area for Golden State, for instance, our water rates are derived from the water. Our infrastructure is built from the water rates and has been for day one of that community.
Okay, I still haven't heard you identify the propriety interest. There was another comment you made that I think deserves some clarification. And how is it that the use of recycled water, which lessens the pumping of the overdrafted lower aquifer in the Los Osos groundwater basin, harm the balance of the basin? By displacing potable water that's now being placed on turf areas of the school with recycled water, how is it that the balance of the basin is harmed there?
It is not a question of how it's harmed, Supervisor Gibson. It's really the question of you're taking the revenue that was generated for the purpose of serving that water to the customers of that rate base. You're taking that away. It's not related to... We agree recycled water is part of the basin plan for the opportunities that it presents.
Well, I thought I heard you read from your letter that the use of the recycled water, that the county's actions contemplated under this agreement was going to harm the balance of the basin. And that, independent of where the revenue goes, the seawater intrusion occurs because water purveyors are pumping more water from the lower aquifer than that aquifer can supply. And with providing the recycled water to the turf areas of the school, both water purveyors will reduce their pumping of that lower aquifer. And so far as any kind of understanding of hydrogeology that I can conceive, will improve the situation in the basin by lessening the seawater intrusion. So the line that I heard in your letter just doesn't compute with me in terms of what the consequence of the action that we're contemplating today.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. And Ms. Tacker, you'll have an opportunity to speak to the board when you're called, so please keep your comments down. Thank you. Mr. Brown, followed by Dr. C. Height.
Mike Brown, representing CoLab. We recognize this is a very complicated project to execute with a lot of pushes and pulls. In your write-up today, it says, a condition of the project's approval was return of 100% of the treated effluent back to the area underlying the groundwater basin. And then it says, additionally, the project's funding approvals from the USDA and the State Water Board each require user agreements for the delivery of the recycled water prior to construction and issuance of financing. So presumably, if that language means what it says, before you can draw down the USDA loan and then ultimately the other loan, you need to have the water under the effluent contracted to go somewhere. It then says, although the initial interest from agriculture is sufficient to meet project conditions, it has been somewhat limited. So I don't know that interest or initial interest equals a signed user agreement, which would seem to be the requirement, one of the requirements for your funding. So you issue these contracts, and I think the staff did hedge a little till we get it fixed. We're going to not issue notices to proceed. So then you get into that dilemma. I have a bid. How long are those guys going to hold the bid? So there's some basic questions that really need to be focused in here. So how much is the total amount of effluent that needs to be contracted? That is, how many acre feet or gallons per year? What is that number? And you may know it, but I didn't see it in there. How much is actually under contract with an enforceable contract now? Now, I guess that school deal is part of it. But is there any more? I don't know. What is the deadline to obtain valid agreements prior to issuance of construction financing by your two big government lenders? And then, and this goes to the question that the water purveyors were trying to make here, if they're selling water from whatever source, potable water now, at certain volumes, and have their capital plans, rate structure, operating costs based on that, and it disappears and is replaced by the county effluent, how is that going to work? So if they have less volumes and less revenue, then they have to get the money from somewhere. Now, maybe I heard something about reimbursing them or something here, or...
Dean Watson.
Dr. C. Hyatt, Los Osos. I believe that the intensity in which this water purveyor was challenged raised, caught my attention and raised red flags and tells me that something's wrong. That's what the red flag does. Why the intensity to try to discredit the water purveyor? Number three, I watched this and couldn't believe it on television, and I think that to go ahead and approve the recycled water agreement in light of the fact that the water purveyors did stand up at that school board meeting and said, well, basically asking for more time doesn't seem all that controversial. Los Osos asking for more time doesn't seem all that controversial. And one thing that does seem controversial, though, is to say, well, just because the farmers aren't on board with this, it should work out in the end. And I've made this statement a number of times. I believe we invest ourselves in truth or deceit, and wrong like interest is compounded daily. And we're just starting to see this expanding pyramid of wrong. We're starting to see where there's problems. If there wasn't such antagonism and trying to cram a supposed shovel-ready project down the throats of the people of Los Osos, then everyone wouldn't be so invested and so defensive about it. You know, we're capable of trying to deal with the problems as they arise, and you're hearing about the problems and just trying to discredit the professionals that are bringing that information to you now is just really not going to work. And number one, I see that now you're going to have bids, and the problem I have with that is, yes, you're having bids, but you predetermined like a parent or a general or a colonel. You outranked the people before they even had their say, and you chose a project for us. You said, well, there was money available, and I was in this room when you came across with the idea of a shovel-ready project, and I mean, my mouth just fell open. I couldn't believe it, because we all know that the project couldn't have been shovel-ready if the people hadn't had their input yet, and the professionals hadn't had their input yet. And when you talk about restoring the site in Midtown, I really hope that you involve the health department, because there actually was some interesting information in the press. When you graded, when not you personally, but when that site at Tri-W was graded and those trees were uprooted, there is an issue of valley fever. Some doctors don't think so, but others do. And it's been documented that there is valley fever in Los Osos. And when you start trenching and you start grading and restoring that site, I want to believe that when we end up in the emergency room with some unknown respiratory problem like my family did, that it can be discovered what it is and not ignored and have the people just suffer horribly for months and months and lose productivity because nobody wants to admit that that's what it is. And you have very silty, drifting sand, and it blows directly towards where I live from Tri-W. It blows directly when they barbecue at Community Center. It blows directly upon us. The music blows in the wind. And you really have put us in a position where we are lower than normal citizens and that our voice doesn't count. And that's a very scary prospect at this point.
Thank you, Dr. Hyatt. Elaine Watson, followed by Gwen Taylor.
Good afternoon. Elaine Watson, Los Osos. I'm here to speak for Richard Marketson. He's out of town, and he asked me to read his comments. All of these comments relate to the contract with the school district, and some of these also relate to Marshall's concerns. The staff report states that the attached agreement includes a 10% discount from current potable rates, water rates. The operative word in that sentence is current. Current rates prior to soon-to-be-approved rate increases being proposed by both purveyors. In reality, with rate increases by both purveyors, the discount will be north of 30% by the time the project is ready and able to deliver recycled water. This fact brings into question the practical application of Section 4.3 and its ability to stabilize future rates at just 10% under existing purveyor rates at this time. Based on the fixed rates in the agreement, Baywood Elementary and the middle school will be paying over $1,800 a square foot, and Monarch Grove and Sunnyside will be paying almost $1,500 a square foot. acre foot, for recycled water. So let's see if this is right. Purveyors will know what their maximum revenue potential is, but they will not know what the minimum is. Besides these points, which may not get addressed today, there are some equity issues that would take far longer to discuss and rectify than the 3 minutes that we have. Both purveyors have registered their displeasure with the way this contract was negotiated without their presence. It's hard to believe that that's just a casual oversight. I think it bears some questioning on your part. That should have been a very important component of this. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Watson. Gwen Taylor, followed by Lindy Owen.
Good afternoon. My name is Gwen Taylor, and I'm a resident of Los Osos in the Prohibition District. Coastal San Luis RCD contracted 20 property owners to take recycled water. From mailings to informal meetings to phone calls up to September 30th, 2011, with only 6 responses, 3 dry farm owners and 3 irrigated agricultural property owners. Those 3 dry farmers have no water to exchange, and the 3 irrigated farmers have only demonstrated an interest in taking the recycled water, as by the Ure County report. The 220-acre now using water and 80 acres in dry farming that could be converted to irrigated agriculture does not comply with the intent of the coastal development permit by the Coastal Commission. Has any supervisor contacted the cemetery to verify their willingness to take the recycled water? Or has any one of you had a discussion with those in San Luis City that provide the recycled water to the Coastal Unified School District and the problems that the staff addresses on an ongoing supply problem of the recycled water to the fields? Do not be flim-flammed in your decisions. Make sure you know what you're signing and agreeing to.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Lindy Owen, followed by Julie Tacker.
Good afternoon, Lindy Owen from Los Osos. We have the 4 issues, and I hope to talk to all of them. I want to start with the USDA loan. The $4 million grant seems to be driving our need to pay higher interest for the $87 million versus doing it with a state revolving fund loan, which was the original plan and was much lower interest and possibly no interest. Instead, I don't know how Pavo got us into this, but now we're stuck with a high interest rate, much higher than I think we should have had. Could you explain, question one, how that it's at the rate is 3.25% interest on that USDA loan, and the discussion that you'll be able to charge 2.75 instead. I don't quite understand what the big thing there is. I'll go to the recycled water, since that seems to be the topic right now that most people are discussing. There's not enough farmers, as you just heard. The 6 farmers that might be willing to take the water do dry farming, so they don't need the water. I guess they could switch over and start doing crop raising now. We have no idea how much revenue that's going to bring for us. Sadly, we will build pipes out to their property, and if they change their mind and don't want to sign on to it, we just wasted a bunch of money getting pipes out to their farmland. Same with the schools. The school can back out in 5 years, I believe, is the contract. They can change their mind and go back to buying purveyor water, or they could put wells in if there's some way to do that. We're paying for huge, costly infrastructure. There's no answer that this is going to get rid of all that recycled water. The Broderson disposal site, as Paavo said at one point, well, heck, if it doesn't work, we'll have to find something else. This is not a plan. This does not resolve all the water that needs to be put someplace, and it's really serious. It's you need to not approve this until we get this straightened out. And the purveyors have a right. The ISJ, that was completely a sneaky act to go behind the purveyors' back and the ISJ process. That just shows you the quality of people we're working with on this. I want to ask about the collection systems B and C, and then the other one, D and E. Are you the plan is to run both of these at the same time? All of Los Osos is going to be completely under construction. Is there any coordination that sections of I guess that's going to be absorbed by the project. And the walkways were never there either legally.
Thank you, Ms. Owen. Julie Tacker, followed by Jeff Edwards.
Good afternoon. I am Julie Tacker from Los Osos. And once again, this is not a project update. At least this time you don't try to use the word update in the staff report description. But, you know, you canceled May 1st. We could have had an all-day workshop to talk about the nuances of this project. There are many. Today I'd like to start with item A. That's the letting of the B and C go out. Let's see those plans as soon as possible. And I think I'd be curious. You mentioned that there's some questions about the air quality. I'd like to hear what kind of questions the contractors are having about the dewatering plan. I think it is quite concerning. Item B, the restoration at Tri-W. You know, that was not loaded on the website, and if it was, I certainly never found it. So today I spent a good hour and a half in the clerk's office reading the plan. I find that, yes, we, the prohibition zone, are going to pay for the removal and reconstruction of a drainage culvert that the county put in just less than 2 years ago. And it was put in, you can just drive by and see that it was too high. And the water went around it, causing more erosion on the Tri-W site. It's premature to let a contract on that site and accept the bids. You don't have a plan for the site that's been approved by the Coastal Commission. The habitat mitigation plan has not been approved. The topography of the site is of concern. The dewatering water disposed on that site is of concern. Maybe a minor issue to you, the Los Osos CSD paid for years for that cyclone fence, the chain link fence around the site, and you're going to pay with the prohibition zone money for that site to be picked up and taken to the Kansas Avenue. Kansas Avenue, the county is going to confiscate the Los Osos CSD's fence. Something's wrong in your plan. There is an addendum to that plan. I wasn't able to see that. I'd like to hear more about that. And I'd like to know what exactly the $35,000 that's in the item is for, that Mr. Paavo Ogrin wants approval for today. Item C, the USD loan agreement. You know, in there it says there is to be no free use of the facilities. And I recall that as an incentive to hook up early, we were going to let people sort of hook up and use the facility without having to pay. It looks from the loan agreement that that use will be precluded. And then the $4 million grant, yippee, We just barely cover our costs that we spent on the Tonini ridiculous pursuit. Item D, with regard to the reuse water in the school district. A backstabbing backroom deal. That's how I characterize it. There's no need to enter into a contract of this type. You don't. If Mr. Ogren suggests that we could have the transferability, well, why isn't that just built into the contract now? Why wouldn't we put the purveyor's concerns to rest now? Build the contract once, build it right, and have everybody on board all together. But no, we have to go behind each other's backs and cause all kinds of turmoil, and it doesn't account for the rate structures that the purveyors.
Thank you, Ms. Tacker.
Thank you so much. And thanks, Mr. Patterson, for that extra minute. That was helpful.
Jeff Edwards, followed by Ben DeFatta.
Thank you, Mr. Patterson. Good afternoon, board members. My name is Jeff Edwards. I'm a longtime Los Osos resident. There are several topical areas I wanted to address before you. First of all, the collection system. A significant issue related to the collection system will be the necessity to dewater many of the areas. And this is a rather sizable amount of water I think we're expecting. I don't know of any calculations that have been performed, but I know it's going to be a lot. We have a perched aquifer in much of the community. And it's unclear how the Broaddrison leach fields are going to be deployed in this connection, and I would like to encourage Public Works staff to go ahead and construct the Broaddrison leach fields very early on and use that as a receiving site for the dewatered material. There will be a couple possible benefits from that. One is in combination with installing 2%. And so one question I have is, when do we plan to go back to the state board for them to consider an interest rate of less than 2%, which it's at now? Also, and I've asked this before, I'm still curious, why did we take the approximately $17 million in total grants and reduce the more expensive USDA loan? It would seem that a prudent use of those grant funds would be to actually reduce the USDA loan instead of reducing the lower interest SRF loan. So I still haven't got a reply on why those grant funds were used that way. Both the USDA and clean water SRF loans require recycled water, water component with this project, ostensibly to address seawater intrusion, which is occurring in the lower zones. But let's be candid. The ag and urban reuse plans that we have on the table right now are simply not significant at all. And I'll speak to the ag reuse plan right first of all. And we're modeled after Monterey. Well, we're different than Monterey Peninsula. Their ag interests were sucking seawater. So they had compromised water quality in their wells. In the Los Osos Valley, the real agriculturists, the real irrigated farmers, they have good water. So there's no motivation for them to take any of this treated recycled effluent. And then with regard to the urban reuse plan, there's been a lot of discussion about the schools. I'd just like to put into context the amount of water that is proposed to go to the schools, and it represents less than 0.1% of our current demands. So this isn't a meaningful way to address seawater intrusion. And if we are going to use recycled water, let's do it in a meaningful way, one that can capture some benefits to seawater intrusion. And thank you for your time.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Edwards. Ben DeFatta, followed by Eric.
Good afternoon, board. Thank you for the extra minute. Ben DeFatta here from Los Osos. This gravity project is going to be a train wreck for Los Osos and this county. As you can see, we are very concerned, Mr. Hill. We're not here for attention. Where are you going to dump the miles of high ground water that's taken out of the trenches during construction? That's question number one. Number two, Mr. Gibson said that after the pipes of dirt is filled in the trenches, the contract will call for a asphalt slurry coating on the streets. Now, with tractors and trucks hauling dirt, asphalt, big pipes up and down the streets, the damage to 40-year-old streets will be horrific. common sense will tell anybody that the 40-year-old gravity base in sand will not hold up another 40-year-old for another 40 years built on sand again. Okay, number three. On the bidding, explain why step and vacuum were not in the bidding. I never get an answer. All I get is, from Mr. Gibson, we're way beyond that. I don't care. I want to know why Mr. Ogden and Gibson won't tell us. And for that matter, bring us all up to date on the whole project. So, Golden State water rates already too high. Sorry to say that, but it's costing everybody an arm and a leg. Now, if you divide 4,600 lots into $200 million, it comes out to over $40,000 per property. That's almost twice of what was, whatever you call it, the bait. Okay, stop the damn project. Start over again, I guess.
Thank you, Mr. DeFatta. Eric Greening, followed by Al Barrow. And Al, that's my last request to speak. Eric?
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and thank you for the extra time. There is a lot in front of you today, and it does deserve a careful look at all the questions that are coming up. I have a few. On the Tri-W site restoration, it's good news that the bid came in lower, the low bid came in lower than the estimate. My question then is, how much of that amount is assigned to cultural resource monitoring, and how much contingency in the event of finding resources? And then I can ask the same question relative to biological resource monitoring. There is no habitat conservation plan in place. How will any take be avoided or responded to if it happens? On the wastewater treatment plant, what is the timing of that big piece? First, the resolution of necessity, then going out to bid and letting the contracts. On the collection system contract, disturbance will be taking place. Do those people exist? What is the plan over the next 2, 3, 4 years to have those eyes in all of the places where they're needed? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Al Barrow.
Good afternoon. My name is Al Barrow, Coalition for Low-Income Housing. Thank you for allowing me to speak for 4 minutes. I guess I want to know what relevance the secret trip to Washington had on this contract. I'd also like to know why the contracts are not online for public review. I would like to point out that there's no step analysis or competitive bidding as promised in the engineer's assessment report. In case you'd forgotten, you got a $25,000 assessment per household agreement based on that assessment engineer's report, which you're still responsible for. I don't care what you say, Mr. Gibson. You don't have the right to take away.
Mr. Barrow, address
all right,
your comments.
I'll address it to you. How's that?
That's better.
You still have, you, sir, as president of this board, have the responsibility to fulfill all the promises that this board made, and one of them was a competitive bidding head-on with Steppen Gravity. What are the impacts? Well, let me tell you what the impacts are, sir. 8 million gallons of dewatering a day taken out of our drinking water aquifer that is in resource management level 3 severity, planned on going to the Tri-W site and down into the ocean. Wasted. 8,700 acre feet. Think about it. That's unnecessary with a step collection system. That violates the rules of your loan agreement. Item 10, item 16, look at it. You must comply with the most environmentally protective approach to the project. How about the LIRE loan? How about the loan disclosure? How about that there's no word in the loan application of August 10th by your board, August 2010, no mention of liquefaction conditions or earthquake faults. And we have this huge seismic study going on right offshore, less than 10 miles from the collection project. The gravity system would be destroyed in 1 minute of earth lurching because you have not required or fulfilled the requirement for mitigating those effects on this infrastructure. That's right, sir. You're supposed to find a way to keep those pipes moving, floating, because they're all in a mapped liquefaction zone. 8 million gallons a day you're going to take and you're going to put on that site that you're going to use the sewer financing to repair. That's against this loan contract. You're not allowed to do that. It's not part of this project. It's part of the last project. You violated so many rules. You violated so many regulations, so many principles. This project is, like Ben DeFada says, should be put in a trash can. And you're responsible for every single lie and misrepresentation and omission. And by the way, omissions are considered lies, okay? That 86-page application for this loan is a sham. And then telling everybody you have a shovel-ready project 2 years ago to get your coastal development permit. You should be ashamed of yourselves. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barrow. That concludes the request to speak during public comment, and I'll bring it back to the board and first Supervisor Gibson.
Mr. Chairman, since there are a number of items within the single agenda item today, I thought it might be useful if staff had comments to take them topic by topic within the items in the order that they're in the staff report. In terms of the plans and specs, the putting out to bid of the second part of the collection system, we do note that the engineer's estimates are low. That's a good thing. I did hear Mr. Greening ask a number of questions about sort of the operational phase of construction. That's not really the item before us today, but I wonder if Mr. Ogren might touch on, you know, what kinds of plans we do have to try to make this the operational phase of construction go as best as possible.
Certainly, and Mr. Hutchinson will also, Mr. Greening, identify that there is no habitat conservation plan right now, and that is correct. The habitat conservation plan, in contrast to the habitat management plan, the habitat conservation plan is something that has to be completed and approved, as well as the local coastal plan and an overall water management plan prior to allowing any new development in the community. But the habitat conservation plan itself is not a pre-construction condition, and the habitat conservation plan is something that we're working on in close coordination with the County Department of Planning and Building. Those cover the notes that I had with respect to Mr. Greening's comments on the collection system. There were some other comments regarding, you know, why, again, isn't STEP or some of the other alternatives included in the alternative bid packages. And that those issues were very much decided during the coastal development permit process and the project technologies that are approved through the Coastal Commission. And so, you know, again, that decision on project alternatives was previously made, and therefore the bid documents reflect what was approved ultimately by Coastal Commission.
A question in this regard.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
So, if I could ask a question in this regard, and it's kind of following up on Mr. Barrow's comment, the $25,000 assessment that was derived, was that based upon competitive bidding? And if it was, did we breach that somehow? Yeah. Or is it, that needs to be clarified.
Yeah, you know, clearly we didn't, you know, breach anything. I don't even think that the litigation that we did face, I can't recall it all, but I think the litigation was focused on rates and charges. I don't even think we had protest on the assessments or any litigation relating to the assessments at all. But the idea that we would make sure that there was a competition was really that first phase of the design build efforts that we did go through and that your board did consider for collection system alternatives. And part of that request for qualifications, contractors did provide us cost estimates associated with the STEP system. They weren't final bids as in the process that we're going through right now. But, you know, in effect, did we engage the contracting community through those prior design build efforts? Yes, we did. Out of the 10 teams or so that proposed, one did identify STEP as the alternative. Did we see cost estimates from the contractor, you know, community in order to be able to compare whether or not we thought that that was an alternative that might be very economically competitive? Sure, we did all of that stuff, but ultimately going through the coastal development permit process, this also significantly weighed in on what are the impacts on coastal resources. And so all of that work that the county promised to do, we did do. I think that some of the challenges that members of the public have is just the conclusions that were reached differed than the conclusions that they wanted to have reached.
I just want to be clear that we're not violating an agreement that was made based upon an assessment that was levied. So,
Supervisor Gibson.
Absolutely not. We won't revisit that assertion. But back, second item is the Midtown restoration. And again, in terms of my observations, very good news. We have a low bid that was some 25% less than the engineer's estimates. And this particular letting of this contract is a very significant milestone in the progress toward getting the full project under construction. Mr. Greening also asked about cultural and biological monitoring during that. And the other issue was the question of fencing around the site. And it's ironic to me there was some discussion about the existing fence, which, so far as my records show, was widely reviled in the community because it's a big chain-link fence that has been sort of neglected over the years. But there is fencing that is going to be established as part of this, and I wonder if Mr. Ogren and Mr. Hutchinson could speak as to its utility at this point.
Mark Hutchinson, Department of Public Works. Yes, the Habitat Management Plan and the construction plans for the project do include fencing, and the details escape me. I know that the fencing along Los Osos Valley Road is to be a split rail design. We took a number of fencing concepts to the LOCAC, Los Osos Community Advisory Council, and made a presentation on what kind of a fence. And the sense was that split rail would be the way to go. Along the backsides is a two- or three-wire wire fence, I think, to demark the boundaries of the site and to deter off-road vehicles.
That's the function. I guess we were speaking to the function of fencing is really to protect the revegetation, as I understood it, Mr. Hutchinson.
Yeah, from off-road vehicles. And then we know that people want to use and enjoy the site like they do today, so the restoration plan includes a perimeter federal site of cultural mitigation and monitoring. So it's very extensive and detailed about where the sensitive areas are, what's known about Los Osos, what kind of monitoring, and exactly what the response would be, both pre-project and during project, and also post-project analysis of any findings. All of Los Osos, as you know, is in a GIS format. It was the first community in the county to be put that way. And that was by intention, so that as we go through the construction and the monitoring of cultural and biological, all of these things, anything we don't know about at this point in time, and we do have extensive knowledge on Los Osos, I should say. The pre-project analysis was very extensive, including subsurface examinations throughout the construction zone. But all of these things are in GIS. As we go through construction and the monitors are there, any new findings will be in GIS. That way, we'll key those to individual parcels so that when someone comes in to the planning department to get their plumbing permit to do their on-lot lateral hookup, we will already know what the situation is with cultural and biological. Regarding biological, by the way, the number of lots out of 4,500 that have biological issues requiring monitoring is less than 10 at this point. Our coastal development permit that the county obtained covers the on-lot laterals. So individuals will not need to go get a minor use permit or coastal development permit. They have that option if they don't want to follow the mitigation measures that are in the coastal permit held by the county. Our coastal permit has counties supplying the monitors for biological and cultural resources. The idea being that people can find a contractor. We will, in essence, pre-qualify or pre-train qualified contractors and provide a list. They could choose from that list, hire one of those guys to do the lateral, coordinate just a little bit with the county. We provide the monitors for both cultural and biological if they're required, and we handle the compliance and reporting on behalf of the community.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hutchinson. Another question that was raised, I think you mentioned it too, Supervisor Gibson, is actually the construction of the project and how it will proceed in the community, I guess logistically, how many streets will be trenched at the same time. I think that'll be a real puzzle to sort out. But what provisions, if any, at this point in time have been made to address the issue of people getting around in town while it's under construction? And also Mr. Greening raised the issue, and I'm sure it'll be addressed with the RTA.
That's correct. Our coordination with the RTA is
going to
be important. The number of mechanisms that are going to be used include door hangers and, you know, a number of different things in order to notify websites. But that the project management team, HDR, is the one that is coordinating and will be doing and coordinating a lot of that outreach. And certainly, you know, in the very near future, we're going to have more town hall meetings in terms of establishing, you know, what those coordination efforts are going to be. But those are covered in the HDR contract and our work that's currently in progress.
So with that, again, the colleagues jump in whenever the topic seems right, but the third item is the USDA loan. Good news here, interest rate dropping from 3.25% to 2.75%, apparently due to the nature of the bond market. I would note, again, this loan is over 40 years, so we've heard some commented about somehow that this is not a good deal, but in fact it is the financing that produces the lowest monthly cost to the community, which has always been our target. I know that this reduction of interest rate will cause some effect on our estimate of cost, probably not huge, but I was curious whether staff had calculated roughly, you know, how that affects our estimates of monthly cost. Is that a $5, $10 reduction?
Yeah, it approaches $5 a month, and the grant component is another, you know, about $3. So these USDA provisions right now, you know, total about $7.50, $8 a month. I think it's important to recognize that property tax bills this year is the first, you know, financial commitment that property owners are paying. So we're not talking about a $7.50 a month equivalent reduction in what they saw in property tax bills this year. But because the funding is being phased in over multiple years, it'll decrease, you know, what they're going to have to be paying in the future and decrease on the long term.
So, and then moving on to the last item, which did get a considerable amount of the public comment, which is the recycled water agreement approved by the school district already. I do appreciate both Golden State and the Community Services District being here, and we certainly, I have spoken to them previously. Yes, the coordination on this matter and giving them a little more lead time could have been better than it. Thinking about it, well, comments been going on as to what proprietary interests they perceive the county to be protecting, nor how the delivery of recycled water is going to harm the balance of the basin. But let's set those things aside for now. I certainly do understand their concerns about revenue, and in the case of Golden State, they are in a particularly complex situation of having to go through the PUC. I do believe that the timing of this, you know, operational phase of the wastewater project works pretty well with the rate structures that the rate timing, let's call it, of both Golden State and the district, as we don't expect to be delivering any significant amount of recycled water before this time in 2015. I do believe we have the framework in place, and maybe Mr. Ogun could comment about how those issues interact with our current litigation under the ISJ of the groundwater basin, I do believe we can work these things out. So understood from my perspective, we're certainly sensitive to those revenue issues. They are revenue issues that will affect the community as a whole, and whether they go here, there, it's more important to me as to how they're used to benefit the community of Los Osos. So, Mr. Ogren?
Certainly, yeah. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to sort of the dynamics on this issue and how they relate to a relatively complicated project. And I think a little bit we have to back up to remind ourselves what are the processes that we walk through in developing a project such as we were doing. You know, from engineering analysis to ultimately environmental analysis, and then walking through coastal resources. And it was really looking at those resource-related issues, then the condition was placed on the project in order to mitigate seawater intrusion to the degree that we can. And part of that analysis is what types of efforts are going to provide better seawater intrusion mitigation versus others. And certainly reducing pumping from the aquifer itself directly from converting the school districts from a potable use to a reclaimed water use is a very, very positive step forward with respect to seawater intrusion mitigation and with respect to resource management. But just like we do engineering analysis and just like we do environmental analysis, some of the actions that we take and we propose then have other effects. And really the other effects that are the concerns of both the CSD and the Golden State Water are really the business effects of their operations. And so as these issues come up and as we take them time, you know, one at a time through our different formal processes, just like, you know, the coastal resource issues and working with the Coastal Commission and getting the project approved, I do believe that we have ample opportunity to address the business impacts on both Golden State Water and the CSD, and in a timely manner, because as Supervisor Gibson had indicated, you know, we won't be providing reclaimed water to the school district in anything less than 2 years, and certainly most likely not for 3 years. And so that timetable, also continuing to work with the purveyors in the development of the basin management plan and the ISJ is you know, certainly a good avenue to continue to address their concerns and how we will address both their business concerns as well as the long-term sustainability of the groundwater basin and future actions that the purveyors are going to need in order to help bring the basin into balance.
And with that, Mr. Chairman, unless you have lights on, I would move we approve staff's recommendation on each of the four items on this agenda item.
Okay, and I'll second. Madam Clerk, roll call, please.
Mr. Gibson.
Yes.
Mr. Patterson.
Yes.
Mr. Meacham.
Quick comment, if I could. And I know you don't want to go back and revisit any of these things. I still very uncomfortable with the cost for the project, and I'm going to continue to raise that issue. And even though we are not going back to revisit the STEP system, I understand that. I'm still concerned that promises made weren't promises fulfilled. And so I'm just going to just raise that one more time. I'll support A, B, C, but I will not support D.
I think
the end result is good. The process by which you got there was bad.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Okay, motion carries. A reminder, we do not have a meeting on May 1st. Our next supervisors meeting will convene at 9 a.m. Tuesday, May 8th. Meeting adjourned.
You're talking about 12-acre feet for the schools, my man.